Welcome to Headlines. This is Ari Wasserman sitting in for David Lichtenstein. Today we are going to be talking about being a shadchan. How do you go about setting up a shidduch? And should each of us be setting up shidduchim? What are the biggest challenges? What are the biggest difficulties? And how do you deal with them? The fee that a shadchan gets paid, called shadchanus, is that only paid to a professional shadchan, or is it paid to an amateur, a beginner? Is it paid to everyone who's involved? What do you have to do to earn the fee? What if you just give a suggestion and that's it? Do you get paid for that? And what advice do professional shadchanim have for amateurs? We have a number of expert guests, wise guests joining us here today. We are going to start out with a couple of poskim. First, we're going to speak with Rabbi Moshe Walter, a posek, a mechaber svarim. He is the rabbi of Woodside Synagogue, Ahavas Torah, in Silver Spring, Maryland. And then we'll speak with Rabbi David Schoen. He has a number of responsibilities, one of which is the Av Beis Din for the Beis Din of Florida. We will talk about the Choshen Mishpat aspects of Shadchanus, the fee, how is it computed, how does it get paid, and is there a difference between amateurs and professionals when it comes to the fee being paid. Then we will speak with two veteran Shadchanim. They're going to come on the show together. We're going to start out with Mrs. Miriam Levitan. She is a noted shadchan in Eretz Yisrael, and also Shlomo Lewinstein. He was a noted shadchan in Lakewood. And together we will compare and contrast the minhagim in Eretz Yisrael compared to that in the United States. And we will also get advice from them for the amateur shadchanim and those who are going to start setting up shidduchim, hopefully, after hearing today's show. And at the end, we will hear from a number of quote-unquote amateur shadchanim. It's not their day job. We'll speak with David Katzoff. He is a statistician, but he spends a good amount of time setting up shidduchim. He's done this for a number of decades. And also, we'll speak with Noah and Ruchama Tradansky. They have been married for just a year and a half and have already attempted 100 shidduchim. It will be fascinating conversations. At the end of the day, we'll also have our wrap-up, takeaways, and lessons learned at the end of the show. Before going to Vort, Dvar Torah, I wanted to play an audio a few weeks ago. I said, please send in your audios to anyone who has an interesting shidduchim or shadchanus story, and somebody sent the following audio in. I'd love to play for you.
Shalom Aleichem. I want to give a small story about the person that set me and my kala up as a shidduch. So a friend that I visited in New Jersey, I had a meal with him, and there was another guy there. And this meal was about 2.5 years ago. And 2 years later, this friend, who that was really the only time I've ever met this other person at the meal, remembered me and set me up with my kala that I'm getting married to in April near Shem. So this man remembered me from one Shabbos meal 2 years later, and just goes to show you the importance of remembering people even in later down the line, and never too late to remember someone. So I have a tremendous amount of hakaras hatov to Mark Ossian for remembering me in that moment, and my kala, and yashar koach to him.
Pretty amazing. Somebody was very alert to looking. What are the possibilities? Remembered somebody 2 years previously, having met him, and thought of the idea of a shidduch from that, and it materialized. So that's so inspirational. Really something to learn from. Keep our eyes open. Opportunities are all around. There's a famous Gemara in Chulin that asked the following question. Esther mina Torah minayin. Where do we have a hint, a remez, in the Torah to Esther? And the Gemara answers in a very cryptic way, quoting a pasuk in Parshas Vayelach v'anochi, haster astir panai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there will come a time, it's a warning, there will come a time when there's going to be Hester Panim, the face of HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be concealed from us. It is going to appear, not the reality, but it is going to appear that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has stopped communicating with us. In fact, that is what the Megillas Esther is, because there is no actual reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But nonetheless, says Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, there is one line in the Megillah that cuts him like a knife. Such language and represents the most powerful statement in Judaism that Hashem has not abandoned us. Where is that? So it's towards the end of the fourth parak. We have a communication between Mordechai and Esther, and Esther is explaining why she is unable, or it's ill-advised for her to approach Ahasuerus to save Klal Yisrael. She gives various reasons for it. And Mordechai responds as follows. Unbelievably powerful language. Ki im ha-charesh ta-charishi ba-esa zos revach ve-hatzala yamod la-yehudi mi-makom acher. In the English, Mordechai sends to Esther, for if you persist in keeping silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another place. Somebody else is going to step into this role. And then the language, the operative language, umiyodeya. Unbelievably powerful. It could very well be, who knows, whether it was just for this that you are now in the position that you are in, being the queen. Unbelievably powerful language. And says Rabbi Sacks, this is the ultimate statement of Hashkacha Pratis, that wherever we are, sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu is asking us to realize why he put us here with these gifts, at this time, with these dangers, in this place. And he goes on to say as follows, the first word in Sefer Vayikra is Vayikra. And if you look at the word, it's fascinating. It is spelled Vayikra with a small aleph at the way end. An aleph is an interesting letter. It has no sound in of itself. A small, non-sounding letter. What is this coming to teach us? It is coming to teach us that it can be very hard to hear HaKadosh Baruch Hu's call. Vayikra, Hashem is calling, but it's a small aleph. It's difficult, if not almost impossible, to discern. Our ears need to be open, because otherwise it's a silent call and we're not hearing it. But the message is, even during the time of the worst Hester Panim, nonetheless, Hashem is always calling on us to do something. Let's refer back to the language of Mordechai to Esther. Umi yodeya im la'es kazos higat l'malchus. Such powerful language. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is calling on each of us, saying there is a reason why we are here, because he has something for us to do. Something that only we can do, and we have to listen to the call. Vayikra, discern it, pay attention. Of course, Esther never would have thought that she'd be in the position she was to save the entire Klal Yisrael. You never know what significance one friendship or one little moment might have for you or for somebody else that you may know. You could change the world. And in fact, when we talk about changing the world, Chazal tell us, Nefesh achas ke'olamale. One nefesh, one person, one changed life is changing the entire world, one life at a time, one day at a time, one act at a time, paying attention, hearing, meeting somebody 2 years earlier and remembering, there's a shidduch that I'm thinking about for this person. Somebody else left us an audio and said as follows, I met somebody who played violin, a nice young lady played violin, and I remembered, I have a relative who plays violin, a nice boy plays violin, Gzeira Shava, and she said, this is actually looking like a nice shidduch, but it was simply triggered by thinking both of them play the violin. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always sending us messages, Vayikra, and we're the only person who may think of that shidduch, and we have to listen, we have to discern, we have to pay attention to the possibilities, and we need to act. Nefesh achas ke'olam male. Before we go to our guest, let's hear the riddle of the week. This week's riddle is from Parshas Vayikra. There's a story. Rebbe Elazar HaKohen Misokachov, he was the Masadr Kiddushin, Chasson Kol, a beautiful wedding. The Chasson happened to be a Kohen. And after the chuppah, Rebbe Elazar gave a beautiful, apparently, a bracha to the Chasson. And he said as follows from Parshas Vayikra, V'kamatz HaKohen Min Mena. He was referring to one of the Korbanos, the Korban Mincha. The Kohen took a kmitza. That's the handful of komets. He took the komets off. He did the kmitza on the on the Korban Mincha, Vekamas al Kohen Mimena. That was the bracha. The chassan had no clue what that meant. What kind of bracha is this? To give a bracha, great gadol, Rabbi Elazar HaKohen from Sukachev is giving me a bracha at the chuppah, right after the chuppah, and the bracha is v'kamas HaKohen Mimena. I have no clue what this bracha means. And the question is as follows. What is the bracha that Rabbi Elazar gave to that chassan? Okay, I can't resist. I'm going to give the answer. I'm going to give the answer to this one because I like it a lot. This is referring to a Gemara that says that in Eretz Yisrael, when somebody would marry a woman, they would say to him, Matzah o Motzeh. Matzah o Motzeh, that's what they would ask him. And what does that mean? The Gemara explains as follows. Matzah, did you find or did you find? Is this a good wedding or is not? Is this a good shidduch or not? Matzah, dichsiv. Matzah isha matzah tov, referring to the pasuk when you say to somebody, was it matzah or motzeh? We're asking, is this matzah or motzeh? If it's matzah, this is a good shidduch. It's a good marriage. He found a wonderful woman. That's matzah isha matzah tov. However, if it's motzeh, if it's not a good chasana, if it's not a good wedding and not a good match, that is referring to the pasuk that says umotzeh ani mar mi maves es haisha. It's referring to the pasuk that says that I found motzeh. I found nothing as bitter than a marriage. In marriage to a woman. So is this a good matzah? Is good motzeh? Is bad? So what's the bracha here? So the chassan turned to his friend and says, what is this bracha I just received? I don't get it. V'kamatzah koyim imena. And the friend said as follows, it's referring to that Gemara and v'kamatz ha-koyim imena. You're the koyim. You're the chassan. You're the koyim. The koyim should have kamatz mimena. Should have a kamatz. That's the vowelization of matzah. You should have matzah from your wife and not motzeh. V'kamatz. You, the Kohen, should have a kamatz from your wife. In other words, she should be matzah and not motzeh. It looks like I just give the answer to the riddle, so I'm going to give one more. We'll see. We'll give some Purim questions, some Purim riddles. So number one goes like this. If we are looking at Tanakh, throughout Tanakh, how many wars were there between Klal Yisrael and Amalek? That is question number one. How many wars between Bnei Yisrael and Amalek throughout the Tanakh? Question number two, we'll focus on the Megillah. Maybe that's much more manageable, much more short, certainly shorter. How many parties, how many mishtaros are there mentioned in the Megillah? So that is question number two, and we'll ask one more. Another question is as follows. Identify, find throughout the Megillah, six different times where we see the midah of midah keneged midah. Six different times where we find midah keneged midah.
If you want to leave a message by phone or dial in by phone to listen, in America our number is 732-806-8700. In England it's 44, that's the country code, 33-011-70250. In Eretz Yisrael it's 02-372-0304.
And now let's go and hear from our guests. Joining us now is Rabbi Moshe Walter. Rabbi Walter serves as the Rav of Woodside Synagogue Ahavas Torah and is the Executive Director of the Rabbinical Council of Greater Washington. Rabbi Walter spent around a decade in Kollel, primarily at the Mir, and he collects smichas. I know of three of them at least. And he has also written a fascinating svarim, actually three fascinating svarim on various aspects of halacha and minhag. Rabbi Walter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rabbi Wasserman. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. It's been too long.
Absolutely.
Rabbi Walter, let's start out with the basics. Is it a mitzvah to make shiduchim? Because that's what we're talking about. Should everyone be involved in shiduchim? Should they spend their time on it? So fundamentally, is it a mitzvah if people are setting up young women, young men, or elderly? It doesn't matter the age. Is there a mitzvah involved in that?
Yes. It's absolutely a mitzvah. So much so you're probably familiar, as are most listeners. One of the zmiros, well-known zmiros that we sing Friday night. Mayididus, we say, Ulishadech Habanos. And indeed, like many lyrics in the Zmiras, they're based upon Gedolei Rishonim, and this indeed is based upon a Gemara Masechet Shabbos, Psak of the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Shabbos, that on Shabbos it's usher to engage in business. Chafotzecha asurim, but the Gemara says that Cheftzei Shemayim umutarim, it's engaged to, it's permitted to be involved in mitzvah business. And Shiduchim L'shadei Chabanos is that mitzvah. The question is, what mitzvah is it? Such a debate actually months later, Achron Wedden and I can even talk about the financial arrangements of the Shiduch on Shabbos. There are those poskim that even permit that, but certainly to talk about Shiduchim, to discuss ideas, many of the times you bump into people or on Shabbos, you speak to people in shul, you see people on the street. So yes, on Shabbos, it's a mitzvah to talk and to discuss and to arrange and to think about Shiduchim. The question is, what mitzvah is it? There's a classic running commentary on Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezer called the Shulchan HaEzer, and he and Simon Gimel writes that the mitzvah to be Meshadech somebody is based upon Ubo Sidvak, that you could connect to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, just like a Kadosh Baruch Hu was Malbish Arumim, was Mevakir Cholim, was Menachem Avelim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, most of his day, based upon a Medrash in two places, a Medrash Rab in Breishis, a Medrash Rab in Vayikra, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, since he finished creating the world on the sixth day, all he does is Meshadech Shiduchim and Mezavik Zivugim. That's what Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta says in the Medrash, and therefore the Shulchan HaEzer says that that is what a person should be doing. It's a mitzvah bo sidbach. That's the first mitzvah. Second mitzvah, arguably, is because of the difficulty of making Shiduchim. We all know Chazal say, Kashe Zivugim Ki Kriyas Yamsuf. Therefore, if you're helping somebody, it's a chesed. It's a form of Haftal Recha Kamocha, Ahavas Reim, and even a mitzvah of tzedakah. People might not be familiar, but anybody who's a Shnai Mikra Echa Targum knows that Rashi in the Pasuk, De Machsaro, Asher Yechzar Lo, Asher Yechzal, you're missing something. What are you missing? Lo Zu Isha, says Rashi. So setting somebody up is actually a mitzvah of tzedakah. So it's Bechlal, the mitzvah of tzedakah, it's a mitzvah of chesed, mitzvah after Echa Kamochim. I have a little bit of a chiddush, and I like to suggest the third possibility. It's actually the mitzvah of Hashabbos Aveda. We know that Chazal say, and it's found in the Zohar, the Ravid brings it in his Hakdamah to Bali Nefesh, that a human being, a person is called a plag gufa, he's called a half of a body. At creation, a person is built with his wife, and then they're separated, and then the goal is to find that person, like the Gemara says in Kiddushin on Daf Beis, that a bal avedas machzir al avedaso. You're always looking for the item that you lost, and Kiddushin is just that. So a person who sets up a young man and a young woman, really what they're doing is they're helping them find each other, and it's a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. I think there's even a fourth possibility. Maybe it's even the most simple. It's a hechsher mitzvah. You're helping somebody fulfill the mitzvah of puravu, the mitzvah of kiddushin, and really the mitzvah of hachmasas kala. That's what it is. At the end of the day, the bottom line, you're helping somebody fulfill the mitzvah that they are required in, to be lifros vilirvos, the mitzvah of kiddushin, a mitzvah of hachmasas kala. So much so, I'll refer you to the Marsha. The Marsha Masechet Shabbos Daf Lamed Aleph says that one of the questions a person is asked at the end of his life when he prepares to enter the world to come, we say asakta bepiriya v'ri. And the Marsha is Medayik. He reads very carefully. The Gemara doesn't say, were you Mikayim the mitzvah of Puruvia? Did you fulfill the mitzvah to have children? Asakta b'peri v'rivia, says the Marsha, is where you osek in Shiduchim. That's one of the most fundamental questions that we will be asked before entering the world to come. Did you engage? Were you involved in Shiduchim? So certainly every person has a major requirement and the opportunity, really, to fulfill these four mitzvahs. The mitzvah of Ubo Sidbak, the mitzvah of Chesed, Avos Reim of Chesed, the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, and the mitzvah of helping somebody prepare for Kiddushin and Puravu.
That is a resounding yes. Is it a mitzvah? That's a resounding.
Resounding.
Yes and yes four times. So tell me, have Gedolim been involved in setting up Shiduchim? Do you have examples of the Gedolim?
Yes.
So walk us through.
There's no question. One of the most fascinating marmakomos is actually a Maharil. Maharil or Yaakov Milon, one of the Gedolei Ashkenaz, who's really established Minig Yisrael amongst the Ashkenazi community. In the Minhagi Maharil, in the beginning of Hilchos Chanukah, the Maharil says that the majority, the lion's share of his salary, annual salary, came from making Shiduchim. That's what he did. He was making Shiduchim, so much so that he writes, because of his importance and because of his stature, he would write letters and would speak regularly, encouraging people to make Shiduchim. And he very, very much encouraged, spoke about, and very heavily pushed people to make Shiduchim. So the Maharil, Gedolei Ashkenaz, absolutely positively did. I'll share with you a fascinating story. The Chassam Sofer, in his, the Sefer on the Chassam Sofer, the biography of the Chassam Sofer, Rabban Shal Yisrael, I don't know if this was an annual thing that the Chassam Sofer did, or if it was one-off, but he tells there that the Chassam Sofer, one Erev Yom Kippur, all day, was busy making a Shiduch. One particular Shiduch, is a Shiduch of a Yosom and Yosom, and orphans, and the Chassam Sofer was so involved in the Shiduch that it spent the entire day in it. it and even came late to Kol Nidre. Chassam Sofer felt it was such a critical thing to do to go into Yom Kippur. We were thinking about the mikvah, we were thinking about Ben Adam Lamakom, Ben Adam Lachavero. Chassam Sofer was worried and was concerned about making Shiduchim. The Radvaz, Rabbi David Ben Zimri, the well-known Meshiv, in one of his tshuvas writes that this is what Gedolei Yisrael should do. They shouldn't be embarrassed, they shouldn't look the other way, but Gedolei Yisrael should engage in making Shiduchim. So much so the Chazon Ish, when he was involved in making a Shidduch with somebody else, he was working on a particular case, trying to be Meshadech somebody, he said, let's go engage in the work of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Bo Nasuk Be'esik Shal Kadosh Baruch Hu. Referring, of course, to the Medrash that I referred to moments ago, the Bo Sidba, Chazon Ish always felt that that was something very important to the stories about the Belzer Rebbe and others. Certainly, I think I've seen with my Rebbeim, I'm sure you've seen with yours, that it's something that great Rabbanim and great Rosh Yeshiva and great people are always thinking about others. And yes, Bo Sidbach means that we connect to Kadosh Baruch and we follow the Masoros of our Rabbanim. And that's something that they always did and did do and continue to do.
How about Rabbi Moshe Walter? Tell me about your experiences.
Now you're really putting me on the spot. Now I'm in trouble. We try. I, Baruch Hashem, have made 3 shidduchim, actually.
Beautiful.
I even made my brother-in-law's shidduch. I was zocher to make. And friends, I think one of the areas that's critical to your listeners and should consider is thinking about the people in your orbit, in your small circle. If it's a brother and a sister, if it's a friend, somebody in shul, in yeshiva, those are the low-hanging fruits, and those are the people you should really be thinking of. And certainly that's an area that I've tried to over the years. Now, in my capacity, in shul and in other places, yes, we're always thinking in yeshiva of other people. I very much try. And you know what? The lesson is that I take away, and I think it's important for people to hear this and understand this, even if you don't make a shidduch, when you call somebody and you say, you know, I was thinking about your son, I was thinking about your daughter, I have an idea for them, you will make somebody's day. You will make somebody's week just to get that phone call to say, I'm thinking of you and I have an idea and let's talk about it. That is worth $1 million. So even if it doesn't go through and if it's not successful and if the other side even says no, the fact that you thought about somebody else is the most important thing that a person can do.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Really, really an important point. So we would say the effort is what it's critical in setting up shidduchim. It's not about the results.
Absolutely. That's the marsha, right? Asakta b'peri v'rivya. It's not kiyamta. It's not about the goal. You know, in Yiddishkeit, everybody always, you know, we have to think about the process more than the goal and the success. We have to do our part. Our part is to try. Kadosh Baruch Hu will decide whether it goes through or not. But we have to make an effort. We have to put our best foot forward, and we have to be thinking about people. Absolutely.
Let me ask you some questions about who you should set up. For example, one thing that comes to mind is setting up 2 non-from Jews. So obviously a concern is they're not going to keep Taras HaMishpacha after getting married. So is there a problem, maybe a Lif Ne'iver or something like that? Your Mikayim, the mitzvah, I would think they're both Jewish, but on the other hand, am I setting up a problem by setting up this Shidduch?
It's a great question. It actually comes up quite a bit, and especially if you're not in a fully from environment. And the truth is, it comes up for a lot of people. You have a family member who's not from. So what do I do? Should I not? How do you deal with that? Yes, you're absolutely right. It's definitely Lifnei Yivir Shaila. And amongst many Lifnei Yivir Shailas, it's actually interesting. There's a related Shaila. And the Tshuva Sakronim, there's a Melamed Lahol about it. Moshe Feinstein speaks about this. Whether or not a Rav could be Mesader Kiddushin for a not from couple or for somebody you know is not going to keep Taras Mishpacha. And there, the Poskim are very hesitant and cautious for the Rav to take that role. Certainly, many Rabbanim have taken the position that certainly the kal in that context should go to the mikvah in order to make sure that he's not being over lifnei iver. But here it's much better, because what you're doing here is making a suggestion. And the poskim debate, when you make a suggestion, just an amira, when you have a language and you speak about it, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to come from that? And it could be arguably that's not even lifnei iver. Lifnei iver means when you're being moshed yayin to the nazir, you're actually handing an article of iser to somebody. Here I'm not doing anything besides speaking, and therefore there might not be an iser of lifnei iver altogether, making a suggestion. However, in the Tshuvas of the Netziv, the Meshav Dover, he actually addresses this question directly. He was asked this question, and the Netziv says, yes, it's really a problem. However, he concludes the Tshuva after a long, long back and forth about the iser of lifnei iver, Mesayeh, Deraisa, Derabanan. He said, if it's Letzorah Parnasa, so for a Shadchun, he said it's Mutter, especially if it's going to cause a problem of Eva, if there's going to be some level of animosity that's going to be created if you're not going to set up 2 not from people. But however, Letzorach Mitzvah, he says, and if it's going to be create some level of Ben Adam L'Chavero, yes, there is something considerable to think about. And I want to mention, I think, maybe what might be the most important thing here. And that is, you know, today there are 2 words that we have to talk about. One is called intermarriage, And the second is called Kiruv, outreach. And both of those are actually very, very prominent today. Kiruv and outreach and connecting Jews back to their heritage is very successful. But at the same time, Kemayim Panim al Panim Zelu Mazeh, is the rate of intermarriages going up. And I know everybody, when they hear of somebody who's not from, a Jewish man who's not from, marry a Jew, engaged to a Jewish woman who's not from, we sort of are so happy and thrilled. Wow, Baruch Hashem, they married somebody Jewish. So I think today we really need to think about, you know, setting up two not from people is a big deal. Because if we could stave off intermarriage, and if we could use that as an opportunity as a front person to be makariv these people, to work with them, to connect with them, it's an unbelievable opportunity. Recently, I had such a situation regarding a girl who's actually not from, and I did set her up with somebody else who's not so from, and I felt there was an opportunity. Me and my wife could sort of create a relationship with them, and wherever the shidduch was going to go, so they're now have a relationship with a from rabbi and rebbetzin. They have a relationship. They heard of us. They talked to them. It creates a very, very strong opportunity for that individual. But more than that, if the shidduch does go through, can you imagine the level of connectivity that that chassan and kala will feel? So I think we have to think about the big picture, not get caught up in the tunnel vision necessarily of mutter, asr, deraisa, derabanan. And of course, it's a serious thing. Talking about lefneiver is isa deraisa, mesayeh is an isa derabanan. The netziv is not so quick to allow it. So we do have to think about whether it's permitted or not. But at the end of the day, there is something that needs to be considered. I will tell you, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, in a tshuva, in a contemporary work called Yismach Lev, was not very excited about this. I do have to mention it. Reb Chaim Kanievsky writes, and I'll quote five words, Im lo yishmeru ein l'shadcham. So for your listeners in Bnei Brak, they should be aware that Reb Chaim Kanievsky had a very, very strong approach to this, and it's actually coming from his uncle, Chazon Ish. And I'll quote the Chazon Ish also, Ki ritzonchem shesayeya, b'shidduch bein ach la'achoso, says the Chazon Ish, that he felt that setting up two not from people was not something that's so ayayay. But again, I think we need to think about outside of Bnei Brak, and I think we need to think about the broader world and connecting with people, the kiruv possibility. Intermarriage is something that's very serious and very real, and the opportunity that exists to set up a man and woman that they could have a life, potentially a really serious Torah and mitzvot, is something in Doros and Doridos. How many people do we know that whose parents are not from? And today are real Bnei Torah and are sitting and are learning and are productive members of Klal Yisrael in a really real way. So imagine their parents didn't marry. What would be? So I think we really do have to think very, very seriously. And maybe we have to do a better job. Maybe we have to speak to the Gedolim about it. Maybe we should set up a shidduch system, you know, for those who are not necessarily from. Something to think about and right. Talk about. And
in your spare time.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Rabbi Walter, next step, but I want to say, lahavdil elef havdolos, how about setting up two non-Jews? And especially in light of the various reasons that you gave, it could be that the first reason, ubo sidba, could apply, chesed, tzedakah, day machsara, it's only if the Jew is with the non-Jew at the same time that we'd have the mitzvah, tzedakah, maybe hashavas aveda. Walk us through your thoughts on two non-Jews. Should we set them up? We don't have the concern of lif ne'iver there. They don't have taras ha-mishpacha, so maybe it's even better to set them up.
It's a fascinating question. And amazingly, it's a question that's heavily addressed in the Gedolei Achronim. In the 1700s and the 1800s, you see an enormous amount of tshuvas that are addressing this very question. It seems to be that this was something that Jews did do or were asking about, meaning there were shadchanim, Jewish shadchanim, who are setting up non-Jews. We struggle enough in this door setting up two from Yidden. So it's not something that you see in the contemporary tshuvas, but it's actually even a tshuva of one of the great Rishon, the tshuva of the Maram Chalava from the Beis Medrash of the Rashba, Talmud of the Rashba. He has a tshuva about this. He was asked this question. The most prominent tshuva on the topic is a tshuva of the Chavos Yoyer. The Chavasar Rabbi Yair Bachrach, the great German posek, the late 1700s, was asked this question, and he quotes from a tshuva of the Rashba, and he says that the Mishnah says in Maseches Avodah Zarah, the third parak of Maseches Avodah Zarah, that it's usur for a doctor or for a midwife to give birth, help a non-Jewish woman give birth, because it's only being marbe Avodah Zarah, it's adding Avodah Zarah.
But the Gemara and nursing as well.
Exactly. But the Gemara says if it's for Litzorech Parnas, if it's a person's business as a midwife or as a doctor, it's permitted. And the Chavos Yoyer says, why should this be any worse? There you're actually helping the non-Jew give birth. and there you're actually helping nurse the non-Jewish child. And if the Gemara says Letzarch Parnasa, that's mutter, the Rashba says the same thing would be true in this context, and the Chavos Yair extends it to Shiduchim as well. The Chavos Yair quotes that in the Tshuva of Rashba, you can take a look, it's an explicit Tshuva of the Rashba. The Ramban, the Rashba's Rebbe, the Ramban himself, was involved in helping non-Jewish woman give birth through medicinal practices, whatever the Ramban did. The Rashba quotes from his Rebbe that that's what he did. So the Chavos Yair says this should be no different. And yes, it would be permitted indeed to help and to engage in setting up two non-Jews. However, I'm going to quote from the Tshuva of the Chavos Yair, who says at his conclusion as follows. Mikol makom, ki baut mi pi gedolim v'sekenos. I have accepted, I've heard, from great Rabbanim and from elders, ki ha-mis'asik be'ela, somebody that engages in setting up two non-Jews, lo yetzei naki mizera shemakdiach tavshilo. He will not see any naches from his descendants. V'nirmas, he brings a remez to this, b'mash amar lo sischatin ba. Pasuk says, simply, the Pashut Pshat means you can't marry a non-Jew. However, the next pasuk says, ki yasir bincha. So he explains that there's a juxtaposition between setting up a non-Jew and then your children going astray. So it's fascinating. This tshuva of the Chavos Yair is the monumental tshuva on the topic, which all later achronim quote. There's a darkei tshuva, there's a ber heitev, there's a mari asad, there's a zera emes about this. Everybody quotes this Chavos Yair. What you see in achronim is that they take it two ways. Some achronim say the Chavos Yair says it's mutter. You can set up two non-Jews, which is true. He quotes
it. But you didn't read the end. You didn't read the end of the tshuva.
So it's fascinating to see how different achronim take and explain and paskin from this Chavos Yair. Some say the Chavos Yair says it's aser, and words like minhag Yisrael Torah and a great iser, and we shouldn't do it. While other achronim say no, the Chavos Yair says it's motani as a Rashba and Ramban to defend him. So you know, certainly letzarech parnasa, there's no question that it's mutter. So if somebody has a non-Jewish dating website that they own, so that's a parnasa, so they would be permitted to do that. Certainly for the sake of Darkei Shalom, if you're in an office setting and maybe you think that two people on a one-off are a good idea or a good match, an argument can be made, according to the Chavos Yair, that it's mutter. But mitzad sheni, you have this, you know, ending conclusion of the Chavos Yair where he says that it's not something to take lightly. So this is a good question. What should be done? How should we do it? How to execute it? But again, Letzarech Parnasa is for sure mutter. If there's going to be Eva or Mishum Darkei Shalom, yes, Lechora, it should be mutter. But again, there are many, many achronim who took this very seriously, that a person can misasik be So you have to think and be cautious about that and consider that too. And there's in the Shulchan Ezer, he addresses this as well. And Simon Gimel, he quotes from these Mar Makomos.
And to set up a frum and non-frum Jew together.
So look, that really goes back to the question you asked regarding Lifnei Iver. This is tricky. This is tricky. If you have a frum man or a frum woman and you want to set up with the opposite, I don't know if that's the best idea. Hashkafically, I think we all know, you want to set up two people who are hashkafically similar. I think we have so many boxes in Klal Yisrael, you know, how many people are so careful not to go out with each other, even within the frum world. It's not terribly common for a frum and not frum person to go out. However, where I do see it is as people get older. And this is not uncommon at all. Once a person leaves their bubble and their orbit and they do get older, so you start looking outside of your circle. And that's when it becomes more tricky. But often what you will see is that the frummer person will bring the other person up. But of course, we can't be blinded to the fact that we can see often the opposite as well. So therefore, we have to think and make sure that we're doing the best and we are setting people up. Ideally, typically, it's not something that I do because I don't think it's wise and it's not going to lead necessarily to a successful marriage when people aren't the same. But mitzad sheni, if there is an opportunity that one could help the other person and grow together, which I have absolutely seen, there could be hope and potential for that as well.
Right, very good. Let me ask you a non-halachic question. What are your thoughts on everyone listening to the show and everyone not listening to the show getting involved in setting up shiduchim? Typically, we rely on the shadchanim, and some people occasionally do reach out. I thought of an idea, and they'll give you a call. Here's for your son, here's for your daughter. Should this be a focus of everyone? And opening up our eyes, keeping lists, maybe a boys list, a girls list, a men's list, a women's list, and trying to make shiduchim, try to make appropriate shiduchim, really try to deal with the quote unquote shidduch crisis that we do have by unofficial and non-professional ways, amateurs getting fully involved in mass. What is your thought on that?
It's the first way to help any person who's looking to get married is that you have to be thinking about everybody. Take time. I don't know if it's weekly, monthly. I know actually certain people that will get together on a monthly basis with lists and just talk of names. And they'll just think about names. I know this person. Do you know this person? And that leads to tremendous tremendous success. We can't just leave this to the professionals. We can't leave it to the shadchanim because it's not going to work. And the shadchanim will be the first people to tell you that. They're overwhelmed. They're overworked. They don't have enough time to set up Klal Yisrael. We're a growing community. We're flourishing, Baruch Hashem. And there are more and more singles that need to get married. You should be aware that the Targum actually says in the beginning of Eicha, Besulos nugos vihimarla. Part of the galus is actually the fact that we're going to struggle with shiduchim. The Targum says that since we no longer have the yantif of Tu B'Av, which was a yantif when girls and boys would have the opportunity to meet and get together, we don't have that anymore. So it's part of the galus. Part of the galus, people have to know and appreciate that this is one of the struggles in Klal Yisrael. We try to fix. You can't fix everything. But if we go in understanding that there's a problem, and it's resulting from the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and we have the opportunity to try to bring a little bit of geula to individuals, yes, we can't give up. The same way we daven for Binyan Beis HaMikdash, and the same way we daven for persons of Refuah Shleima, we have to daven that people will be able to meet each other. But more than daven, we have to be mishtadel too. And we have to work and come up with ways and contemplate people getting together, programs, events, speaking to people. But the regular lay person who's not a shadchan must think about other people, friends, neighbors, people in shul, colleagues, anybody who you know, and especially when it comes to older singles, which is really something that needs to be addressed more and more. It's a chelik of Klal Yisrael that needs a lot of attention, and it's a group and it's a population that we need to think about. And Baruch Hashem, there are many people who are thinking about them, focusing on them. There are Shabbatons, there are get-togethers, there's speed dating. We need to be making a greater effort in this area. We need to be concentrating on these people and doing whatever it is that we can to show them how much we care. I could tell you in people that I know, and certainly my shul, many of those older singles feel left out. They feel forlorn. They feel lost. They don't feel that there's a place for them in the from community without a family, without a mishpacha, without sending your kids to yeshivas and schools, etc. We don't belong. We need to make sure that everybody feels that they belong. And one of those ways of doing that is by making sure that we are thinking of them, calling them, talking to them, asking them, what are you looking for? Tell me about yourself. Just having that conversation is so meaningful. And there are a lot of people are doing that, and a lot of organizations are doing that. They really do get a lot of credit.
Right. And one last question for you. You had mentioned online dating, and I wanted to get your thoughts. Somebody comes to you in your shul. I'm not being set up. Could be an older single. You just mentioned older singles, and they're not getting calls about women, men, whatever it may be. And they say, should I give a shot at it? Online dating, you may not know what you're getting. Is that something that people should attempt, or should we stay away from that?
Actually, very interesting. So I've changed my tune with this quite a bit. I'm married, Baruch Hashem, close to 25 years. And when I was dating, it was a strange thing to do. It was almost unheard of. But the truth is, like all areas of online world, it's changed. Who doesn't shop online? Who doesn't do everything online? You know, you order a pen, you'll order it online from Amazon, that it comes the next day, you're not going to walk into a store anymore. Online dating has become a reality. And online dating has become very successful. And there are different sites, and you have to know how to use it. And there are sites that engage shadchanim, and you could talk to somebody, and there are different types of, you know, people that you could meet, and you could connect with this type of person, that type of person. This is who I am. I take online dating now very seriously, and I think it's a real thing that people should contemplate. I've actually encouraged and pushed people who are struggling in dating to sign up to some of these dating sites, because I think there is something out there. Does that mean that it's the answer? There's never one answer. But I think it is something that people should think about, should consider, and working with somebody understands how it works. And like I said, many of those sites have people who you actually can talk to. You have a set up shadchan that you can make and develop a relationship with. And it could be just, it starts the process for some people who are struggling, who are not getting any referrals, or somebody's not making suggestions too regularly. Take a look. You know, you can't say no anymore. It's certainly an area, and I've seen tens of couples, tens, and I think others probably would say even hundreds of couples who are successfully married with families that have been set up and have met online. So I think it's something for sure to think about. It's not considered to be strange and out of the box anymore. It's a reality. It's normal. The world of online has, you know, taken over, and we have to know how to use it, that it's not abused, and that we're not taking advantage. And like all areas of internet use and access and engagement, the same thing is true here. You have to be smart. You have to be thoughtful. You have to deal with it in a wise way. But yes, a person should think about it, should consider it, should talk to people about it, because there has been success and certainly a new upgrade for many, for sure.
Very good. Rabbi Walter, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you letting me add on non-halachic questions to our discussion. Very much appreciate
it. Always a pleasure. Look forward.
Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Joining us now is Rabbi David Schoen. Rabbi Schoen is the Rosh Kollel of the Choshen Mishpat Kollel of Miami. He's also the Dean of the Florida Center for Jewish Ethics and also the Av Beis Din for the Beis Din of Florida. He frequently lectures to a wide range of audiences around the world, including to attorneys, business owners, doctors, and university students as well. Rabbi Schoen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Shavari, for having me. It's good to see a fellow Angelino again and see that you have well adjusted here in Eretz Yisrael. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to see you as well after such a long time. So we're together, by the way. People don't see us, but we are
that
together.
That is correct.
Sitting in Yerushalayim, Baruch Hashem. Rabbi Shon, we are talking about Shadchanim, Shadchanus. In particular, we'll get to talking about amateur Shadchanim. But why don't we start at the beginning and talk about shadchanus. The fee that is paid to a shadchan, is paying a shadchan required by halacha? And if so, what's the source for the obligation?
Okay, let's give a little bit of a backdrop to this before we get into specific answers to your very good questions. Number one, some hold that the esek of shadchanus is actually a mitzvah. Some say even a mitzvah d'oraisa. And they bring it from Medrash Tanhuma in Parshas Yisro, it's also in Dvarim Rabo, that Moshe Rabbeinu, as a compensation for being a sarsor between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, got the Keren Or. I'm not entirely sure that that's a good raya. It could be that he got it. It doesn't necessarily indicate.
A sarsor meaning a shadchan.
A shadchan. Well, the fact of this, it's exactly what it was. So it doesn't say that it was a requirement. It could be that it was a matana. So I'm not sure. But people do bring that as a raya that it's actually a mitzvah. Just in historically speaking, the Baharil, great Baharil, strived to get most of his parnasa from shadchanus. He felt it was a very clean form of remuneration. And it's brought down that that was his goal. The Maral, it's brought down that he actually reserved the money he got for shadchanus to purchase his dalad minim. Presumably, the rationale was that the money also has to be lochem for you to acquire a lulav that's lochem. I assume that was the rationale. I didn't see that inside, but presumably that's what it was. Interestingly enough, something happened to Smenat Shemaim. Last week at Kabbalah Shabbos, not during davening, because I know how you are about that. At the corner of my eye, somebody was reading from Zilberstein's emails that he sends out. And the word shadchanus caught my eye. Now, that's not coincidental. So I saw, and I asked to see it afterwards, there's a Peli Yoyetz. And the Peli Yoyetz says something quite fascinating in the area of advice. He says, don't be so quick to give advice. It's not a good idea. If you're Matzliach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets the credit. If Chas V'Shalom, you're not Matzliach, you gave a bad advice, you're going to bear the brunt of the consequences. And then he said, I'll read it to you. It's unbelievable. He says, a person should avoid, I see your eyes are popping up.
Absolutely.
Let's get
it. What does he say in the Hamshach?
No. He said, if there's nobody else around, obviously, but it's not something you should endeavor to do unless it's necessary. Now, that is not the case. That's not normative halacha. It's moved to the opposite extreme. People today are encouraged to everybody and their brother to participate in shadchanus, presumably because of the situation, at least in the Litvish world, there seems to be a greater supply of males and a shorter supply of females. Some argue it's just a mathematical thing. It's not so. It's just because when they start dating, etc., and then the girls get older, and you know, the shelf life, unfortunately, for lack of a better word, in the film world for girls becomes much more challenging as they get older. That's not justifiable, that's the mitzvah. So I presume that's what has created this idea that people should endeavor to be a shadchan in any fashion or form. Not necessarily as a form of remuneration or compensation, but rather just to help out. So that's clearly not normative halacha. Now, it's interesting. The Svardim I don't know how broad-based it is, but the Svardim don't take shadchanus gelt. I can't say all Svardim because it's a mitzvah.
According, it's a mitzvah.
They feel that they want to do it for the mitzvah shadchanus. Now, I've asked around. I don't know what the minhag in Eretz Yisrael is. I give a shul once a week up in Hollywood at a shul where the Rebbe is a Sfaradi, and I ask them.
Hollywood, Florida.
Hollywood, Florida, yeah. And there's no shiurim in Hollywood, California that I'm aware of at all. A place to stay far away from. In any event, he told me that he actually gets parnas from Shadchanis, and his Rebbe also did. But he said it could very well be because they went through the yeshiva system, and maybe that's the case. I don't know. Apparently, though, large swaths of Svarim will not take compensation, which begs the question. If it's a mitzvah, how are we allowed to take payment for it? Right? The Gemara Darm says, Mani b'chinam, afatam b'chinam. So some say it's a schar batola, like anything else, like a melamed, if it's piece of tamen, whatever it is, or shmira, or schar batola for a dayan. That's how it would work out. Now, interestingly, just parenthetically, the Nesivis, in Reish Sam Gdalit, he just, Agavurcha, he mentions that Shatonis is not a mitzvah. Just, he bundles it up with other things. He's not addressing that per se, it's just part of the Mas and Madin, what he's dealing with over there.
Which is much more beneficial for getting paid then.
That is exactly correct. That is exactly correct. So, I don't really see that people are reluctant to do it. By the way, just because you're getting paid for something doesn't mean you're not doing a chesed. If you're a doctor, or even if you're providing a comfortable kosher retreat for people, I'm not talking about with all the giant smorgasbords, but any form of things where you're helping people out, and even though you have to charge for it, that doesn't necessitate not calling it a chesed.
Right.
So it could very well be. So, as far as what you're asking me about the makor, so really there are two general approaches to the sourcing and the mechanics of what creates the shibud for payment for shatfonis, for those that get payment. So, if you look in the Marshtam, and he brings down the Rambam, it says all in Hilchos Shluchim, you tell your shliach to do something. Normally speaking, dibur bi'alma does not create a shibud. We know that a person needs to keep their word, right? But someone that violates the word, while it's morally reprehensible, they're called mechusar amona, it's not actionable in Beis Din. But the exception to the rule is a shliach, which is essentially a poyel. With a worker, the halacha is brought down in Shin Lamed Gimel, the minute that's the Gemara, the minute they start the work, the baal by default is subordinated to pay the poyel. The poel can be chayzer because he leave in esol avadi avadim, right? Avadi leave alay avadim avadim, but the baal, except under certain circumstances, mishubit to pay. So that's what creates the shibud without a kinyan. Obviously, there's a kinyan for sure is mechuyav, but here in the absence of a kinyan, it falls into the same mechanics. That's one approach. The other approach is yoyrid l'stei chaveri. Fascinating halacha, set of halachas brought in Shin Ayin Hay. A guy walks into your field, unbeknownst to you, and he plants a whole bunch of trees. Now, you didn't ask him to do it. If it's osed lita, if it's something that is beneficial, then you were planning to do it, you're happy with it, so then you're mechuyav to pay him. What you're mechuyav to pay him, that's a whole discussion in the Rishonim. But I just want to point out, it's brought in the Simon of Hilchas Gezela. It's not a good thing to do, but at the end of the day, you have provided a benefit to another person, and you're a Mahanahim, and consequently, he would have to pay. The Din Yairid, the Vilna Gaon is really the prime source for this in Kuf Pei Hesif Kot Yud Gimel. When it comes to the Din, the Ramah is the one who actually brings down V'chein Shachin. The whole discussion in Kuf Pei Hesif is a sarsor. The Ramah brings Shachin. So the Muhammad doesn't even mention Shachin. So that could
maybe
be.
Maybe that's the difference between Ashkenaz and
exactly, Sfar. Precisely correct. That seems to indicate something of that nature. Okay. But I saw, interesting, one of the Gedolei Poskim, he says it cannot be from Yerid. It's impossible because it's not comparable. You need to have a hana muhashis, right, muhashit, that it has to be a tangible benefit, i.e. planting trees. A non-tangible benefit does not translate into a choiv for Yerid l'stei chaver. Therefore, he says it always and only is midin poil, not midin Yerid. Okay.
And it's intangible when getting married?
What do you provide? You're providing a hana, but what's the tangibility?
It's interesting. It would be mechalik. Otherwise, yored, you're doing something without request, and you may not even know about it. But if it's a shadchan, you're very aware, and you're...
No, so that's yored b'rshus.
So that would be more like...
It's yored b'rshus. It still has the same dinim. It's not yored shalor b'rshus, obviously. You can't just take the girl and the boy and just put them together and tell the parents after the chas and then mazel tov, right? That obviously, that would be the first... Now, many say, though, that they divide it up this way. If the parents approach a shatkin, then he has a din of a poil. If he approaches the parents, he has a din of a yorid. And there's a series of nafkaminas which we'll get to. And some say, if he approaches the parents, if he approaches the parents, he's a yorid. And if they approach him, he's a poil. And some say, from the moment the parents, let's say you approach the parents, and they say, yes, we'd like you to continue with the shidduch. From that point on, many say he now has a din of a poel.
Okay, very good. So let's talk about professional shadchanim versus amateur shadchanim. One time, first time, beginner's luck. It seems that all this would apply regardless. It doesn't matter if it's a professional.
Yes and no. So the backdrop to all of this is that we have to be aware of the governing factor always is minhag. When you're dealing with poel, for example, the Gemara discusses that if there's a default halachic position, that a worker has to get up at a certain time after nates and he has to work till tseis, That's the halacha. But let's say you live in a town where it's 9 to 5. It's incumbent on the masker to say that he's deviating from the customary business practice and he's going with the default halachic opinion.
That's the minhag medina.
We call it in the Gemara in Yerushalmi because of minhag mevatel halacha. That's only in Choshen Mishpat. It's not in any other areas of halacha. Gedorim for it. So it could be, I'm just thinking out loud, if you hire them as an amateur, you went to them, and there's a big distinction between a first-time novice and a professional, then they would get paid based on what a novice would do. But the argument could be made that if it's Yoyrid, you went to them, that benefit you derived is, it's indistinguishable from anybody else. What do you care? Perhaps that would be the case. I think by and large, usually, we had our youngest was when he was. By the way, all my children are married, so I don't really care anymore. I get in too much trouble here. But I think it was a married young girl that recommended, and she was given less than the shatran on the other side. Okay, so again, the minog is. It seems that there is some distinction. I have not heard anyone make the distinction in Yared. Again, everything's at kolufiyam bokum v'azman, and the minog is what always governs. Before I just wanted to say some very important nafkaminas that are important to note, whether you're Yared or Poyel. Number one, if it's a poil, then whenever the payment is due, which I'm sure you're going to ask me, right? If you do not pay where the guy asked for the money and it's now due, you could be over baltolin, as is discussed in Shin Lamites, which is a serious matter. Another thing is shavu kesef. If you hire a poil, you're obligated to pay him in cash. You cannot pay him in shavu kesef, as opposed to a yoyred, you could do it. Another fascinating thing, I think this has very big ramifications, so I want to just develop it for a little bit. There's a fascinating din in Shin Lamet Zayin, hufus poil, that the Gemara discusses. You know, a worker, when he's working the field and he's picking fruits, for example, he's allowed to eat from those fruits. But he's not allowed, if he's working grapes, he can't eat figs, or vice versa. The Gemara queries, how about if he's eating grapes over here? Can he take from grapes over there? It's a neboya delay ifshita. The Gemara doesn't resolve it. Yet, oddly enough, the Shulchan Aruch and everybody but the Taz, if memory serves me correctly, says that if he did do it, you can't take away what he ate. And not only that, you have to pay him his schirutz. You can't deduct it from his schirutz, which flies in the face of everything we know about Choshen Mishpat. Hamotzi mechaver al-baraya, he's muksik bedamim, and he could say kimli. So there's a long discussion. I have a mahalach in it too, but we don't have time for that. But the Shach discusses it, the Kunshus HaSvekas discuss it. It could very well be this has, we'll see where there's different minhagim, and it's a question is what has to be paid. Maybe this would also be applicable as well.
Based on all that background, Yored, Poel, in order to earn the fee, because oftentimes the poel has responsibility. Yored, you go into somebody's field, you better perform the duty. So to be a shatran and to earn the fee, what's necessary?
Very good question. So let's break this up. This is brought already in the Pesukei Teshuvah. There are essentially three possible roles that a person can play in a shidduch. One is the maskil, who suggests the shidduch. Two is an emsoi. This is around Pesukei Teshuvah Kufpehe, if you want to take a look at it. Someone that has to carry the water somewhere in the middle. And then the goymer, which is the hardest thing to do, is to actually close the deal.
Close the deal.
Right? Now, there is lengthy discussion as to what the appropriate payment is for each of those respective roles. So let's start with the maskil. The maskil, although it's brought in Pesukei Teshuvah, it used to be that he split it, if there's no emsoi, let's say, with just the goymer 50-50. The minhag seems to be today, the maskil gets 1/3, and the goymer gets 2/3.
That's assuming no one is in between the maskil and the goymer.
No, that's true. So we'll come to emsoi in a moment. Now, the question is, what is a maskil? What qualifies you as a maskil? Obviously, if you write up a list to somebody, you name every single bacher in the entire tri-state area, and that's not called haskala. It means nothing, right? Or the case that's discussed in the Shevi Yaakov is the following. You had a maskil, he recommended a shidduch, and nothing happened. Later, a second person, unbeknownst to him that the first endeavor to try to do the shidduch, he thinks it's his idea, and he comes to the sides and he is metapa with them. So then the Shev Yaakov says, if he did it independent of the first, he had no knowledge, then the first doesn't get anything as a maskil. And the second gets, either if he's a maskil, he gets a third of it. If he's a maskil in the goymer, he gets everything. And the Erech Shai also says a similar thing. He brings a fascinating raya, kind of an Avnei Nezerish type of Midama Milsa Lomilsa. He says, in Hilchot Shabbos, in the laws of Tzedah, you have a deer, let's say, inside, and now you want to close the gate to trap it in. If one guy can close it on his own and another guy can't, and they do it together, only the guy that's yochel to do it on himself is chayiv. If they're both not able, then they are both chayiv. So he wants to compare it to this case over here. Okay, since the second one was able to do it completely and the first one wasn't, he gets all of the shadchanis. On the other hand, we have opposing opinions on this. I never knew about these shuvahs until I started going through the sugya. Rav Yedidya Teil Weil, who was the son of the Korban Sinai, and he says no. The person is called a maskil, And it seems that's also the Noy de Behuda's opinion. And why is that? Think about it for a moment. Even if the second guy didn't know about the shidduch, somebody approaches you, they approach, you know, Beryl Shmerl as a potential shidduch for your daughter. Okay? You say, I don't know. Doesn't sound so great. Next week, another guy comes up with the same. You say, you know, wait a second. Two guys? That's kind of interesting. Two separate people made the recommendation. So he would be entitled as a maskil to something. Maybe it's a six, whatever it is. It's like the proverbial pickle jar analogy. You try to open the jar, nothing happens, and then another guy comes along. It's probably very arguable that your endeavors at the beginning loosened it a tad. And I think that's the rationale behind that. So it is a machloikis, and it seems that the ones have it, some remuneration should be given, but it is a machloikis as far as that is concerned. Now, that's only if you were metapil with the families. How about you had some... Because you're asking...
That's not only making a suggestion.
Right, making a suggestion to the families, right. But let's say you mentioned it casually to a shatran. Okay, so that becomes a big question, whether that enters in and raises you to the level of being a masr. Now, many people hold, from this and Karelitz and others, and it's brought into Tivu Kalocha, that you get zero. You have to, at the very least, to be considered a masr, whether you go, the earlier illustration was you were metapil with the families, it just didn't end anywhere. Here, with just a simple idea, many say that you don't get anything. However,
metapil means speaking with both sides or suggesting.
Or if it's one side, you would get a six instead of a third, uh-huh. Right? According to those opinions, correct? Because there would be two, you would only be entitled half of that portion. Now, they do bring down, though, that Rav Nissen, on the other hand, recommended that a person should get one-sixth. And there's a organization in Lakewood called Newly Reds, R-E-D-S, which we understand what that means. From a political standpoint, it's not such a good name for Jews to have, Newly Reds. But but they say Rav Horsheimer Shlita, he recommends that it's an organization where people just recommend shidduchim. They tell shadchanim. And they get some type of a stipend. They set up four. Shamer says perhaps a six. They should get a six, which I don't understand. Because if they're not Mikar Hadin entitled, you're taking away from the other guy. I don't exactly know how that works, how Rav Nissen works. If the first guy's not called a maskil, it's very nice to be frum with someone else's money. I don't know, or unless they mean that you have to be maisif an additional sixth for that person. I'm not sure.
Unless they're all agreeing to the system and those payments when they're participating.
So then that's something else. And then it's implied consent, of course, and then Aldas came. Right, then that's for sure. It's a good point. That could be. But in the absence of that, it would be, again, you're probably right. And that organization, since they know those are the rules, so then perhaps that is an implied mechila from the start. That's a fair point. Right. But in the absence of that, it would be hard to understand how that would work. Emsoy. So sometimes you have the water carrier in between. It might be arranging dates or problems that come up that they have to, I mean, I've heard now they have dating coaches.
Very popular.
Yeah, so it seems things are getting infinitely more complex with our younger children in terms of relationships, and they already have coaches that are trying to keep things going along. Now, a lot of times the shatran themselves play that role, but sometimes they bring in a middle person, and that's a very big question. In the Pisvei Tshuva, the Ateres Tzvi is brought down, that he found that in some communities, the minhag was not to pay anything, and some say to pay a third. The Aruch HaShulchan says, in Eben HaEzer, in Simen Nun, he says that Meikar HaDin and Emsoi doesn't get anything, but you should give him Dover Ma, something. On the other hand, Rav Yehuda de Viles, we quoted before, he says you have to really make an honest assessment of the situation. If the Emsoi did a Pu'ula Toiva, you have to be very careful about these things. When you see that he was critical in the Hemshech of the Shidduch, it could very well be that he's entitled to one-third of the Shadchanus. So
it's very subjective.
It's subjective, and therefore, when you get to a murky situation like that, it's best to speak to a rov. Mm-hmm. You don't want to chas v'shalom. There are many, many stories where a shatran wasn't paid, or paid as much as they should have. There were shalom bias problems after, people not having children. It's a very serious matter. It's a kofri toiv. You really have to be very, very careful about these things. You don't want to leave it where there's some type of a taina.
Let me ask you about the timing of the payment, because you brought a nafkamina between Yorod and Poel before, relates to that. Is it paid upon engagement? Mazel tov, now pay the shatran. Is it marriage? And unfortunately, we're seeing nowadays there are hiccups, or much more than a hiccup along the way. If there's a broken engagement, if the fee was paid and the engagement is reneged, rejected afterward, or maybe an immediate divorce that is happening more and more. So
you have a series of questions here. When is it due?
Are there refunds?
Right. Are there refunds? Right. What, a 30-day money-back guarantee of some sort? Well, the Rama brings us down. He says, Yesh Nog, and some people, they paid at the Tanoim. right? And I know in Eretz Yisrael it's more prevalent that people actually at the Vort will draw up to Noyim, and with the requisite kenosos that are going to have to be paid if one side breaks the engagement. In America, a Tanoim are really a formality because...
And it's only at the Chas.
It's only at the Chas. I'm saying, what's going to happen between the Tanoim and the Chas? I remember we had a case where a Korov signed by mistake of the Tanoim. By the time they realized it was already under the Chuppah, it was on Nafgamin at that point. So he says it depends on the custom. If the custom is to pay at the Tanoim and he was a Poyel, if you don't pay on time, you're over batalon. If he's a yoyred, then you should still pay, obviously, but you're not over batalon, right? A person should not withhold payment to any form of a worker, regardless of how he got you there. In a case where the Ramah brings, where the minhag is to pay at nisuin, so then that's fine, and this has a nafka min. If chas v'shalom, the engagement is broken off between the tanoim and the wedding, if there was already chalois to pay at the tanoim, then obviously you have to pay at the tanoim, regardless of what transpired afterwards. But if it's at nisuin, then there's no choiv. The Ramah speaks about this specifically. As far as mekach tois goes, so you have to really analyze. I was told this past week a startling figure, which is very concerning, that in some community in New York, there have already been 60 cases of people being divorced in the first year of marriage.
Large community.
Yeah.
Tri-state area.
Yeah, well, okay, let's leave it at that. But yeah, but it's large enough, regardless of how many, we're not talking about a community with 70 weddings that year. We're talking, it's in the first year, not to get through the first year. Clearly something is happening in that area, which is not the subject of our discussion, but it has to really be a big mekach tois. Not like I saw him wearing a blue shirt when he was on vacation. It has to be something serious, right? If it's a genuine medical issue.
But these are 60 divorces, not mekach tois.
These are divorces. So the question is, you're asking me now, can they go back to the shatran?
Yeah.
So if the shatran withheld very important information, then of course it's a mekach tois.
Or
he wasn't aware of it. And then you would get a refund. It's like any other mekach tois, right? But it really would have to be something substantive. And again, how we remarked that seems to be a bit of a question.
Okay. And when it comes to the amount of the fee, and also a related question, should the fee be discussed in advance, or is it just a davar yidua? People know what
the fee is. Great question. Let's put it this way. It gets very murky, because there's a whole discussion in the poskim. Let's say you have Eretz Yisrael family being mishadech with an American family. The prevailing rates of these two communities are vastly different, and it's a long discussion. Ponemir says one way, Rav Moshe says another way. The minhag seems to be that if the person was approached as a poel, he gets paid based on the rates where he is. If he is a yoyre, then he gets the hano that he bestowed upon the people. Rav Moshe has a whole different take on it. We don't have time for it. So it's not always clear what the payment is. If there's no ktsitsa by a poel, the usual rule is that you get pachsha b'poelim. I'm not sure that's the case here. Because generally speaking, the reason people don't nominate a price at the beginning, I saw an interview with some very choshev shatchanim. And these are talmid chachamim in a serious b'nei Torah. They said there are certain shatchanim that advise their price ahead of time. And by the way, there are some shatchanim that charge huge amounts of money. They specialize, shall we say, in high net worth individuals that have very few children. If it's girls, it's great to the entire yarshim for this. There's no boys. I'm just kidding. But they do charge a lot of money depending on what the schoyer is that they're trying to peddle.
So there you would have to discuss it in advance.
Well, unless it's known. I'll give you an example. You're familiar. You go into a Century City law office and it's got all the accoutrements. You know that these guys are not charging $100 an hour. But generally it's like, now they commented on this interview. It was very fascinating. They said some of these people do now nominate the price ahead of time, but they felt it wasn't a nice thing to do because it becomes much more of a business. And I do hear them. That's a very Ehrlich approach. But on the other hand, it saves a lot of problems down the road. They mentioned in the interview that one guy got burnt out having to fight for this payment afterwards. So it seems to me that it would be better. Again, who am I to say? I'm just saying from my opinion, because you're asking. I think in Eretz Yisrael, they do nominate the fee ahead of time. In America, it's much more na'im, there's more na'imus, but it could result in much greater problems. The Chofetz Chaim is very clear in Avos Chesed. When you hire a worker, you better make sure to nominate the price, because somebody is going to walk away unhappy. So I don't know why this should be different. I respect them. They know a lot more than I do, certainly about Shadchanis. And it seems like it would be a greater problem would be avoided. It used to be that in the old days, a lot of the tafkid of the shatvin was the nagin, how much the young couple's going to get. So it was between 2 and 3%.
Negotiations back.
Yeah, right. So if they would tie it to that, if it would have a profound effect. Why? Either people will start spending less on the weddings, because that would be in the calculation, or the shalchanim are going to get more money. But there's more of a yardstick. That's not going to happen. The other problem also is, you know, when you spend a lot of money on weddings, and then all of a sudden you have to pay the shadchan. It's not fair, but the psychology is like, I just spent all this money and you want this? It's not right, but that happens more often than not.
There wouldn't be a wedding without the shadchan.
That's exactly correct. You're paying all the things for smorgasbords and all the necessary, quote-unquote, things that have to be done at a wedding. So, yes, that would be... So it's not discussed in America. I believe it's advisable, but again, these big shadchanim, they feel otherwise, and obviously we have to respect what they're saying.
Right. They feel uncomfortable discussing it up front.
But I said, just because you're charging money doesn't mean you're not doing a chesed. Right. You have to eat.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. They're focused on this full time, more than
full time. It's a big job. And I don't know what the percentage hit rate is for these things. It's very, very, very challenging.
Right. It's not easy work.
No, and you're also mitigating machlokes later on, and there won't be bad feelings.
Right. So this is an interesting question, and this definitely comes up. Two shadchanim come to a father, a mother, with the same idea. And they can't come at the same time. So one comes today, one comes tomorrow, one comes in a minute before, one comes a minute later. The person who receives that exact same suggestion, are they obligated to go with one shadchan over
depends.
The other?
If you didn't accept the advice, then you could pick whoever you want, in my opinion. There was a case, Rabbi Yisrael Gross, and that's if Yisrael had a case where a mother was approached by somebody and she accepted the husband by another person, the same shidduch, but he said once, Ishta Kagufa, he said once she was mekabel, then you have to do it. And Lanias Daiti, if there was no Kabbalah yet, you haven't done anything.
Kabbalah is giving a yes.
Yes.
Once you yes. Say yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes is yes.
Okay,
yes, correct.
Very good. Changing shadchanim in the process. Once you said yes, and then maybe they're dating already, and you said, I've had enough of the shop, and it's not working, we need somebody more professional. It could be our question, going from an amateur to going to a professional.
Okay, fair question, very important question. A pottering or removing a shotgun is a very, very serious issue. If there's no genuine reason to do it, if it's for a cavalier reason, or you want to bring in your buddy, or your relative, a relative that's allowed to take shatchanos, we haven't gotten to that discussion. The Aruch HaShulchan is very strong words. He said, Yer Shemayim should be stay far away, and in Ebenezer it could be Gezel. But, Rav Moshe makes a distinction. The Noi Debi Yehuda says you could bring people in, your Karav, it's Maisim Shvachol Yad. So Rav Moshe asked him, how could that be? So he said, he must be talking about that you're a Yairin. If you're a Yairin, you come in, you're not my poil. I didn't nominate you so I can get rid of you. But if you're a poil, if I hired you, then how can I possibly just get rid of you? I'm Shuba to you, correct? Now, if there's a genuine reason, and that happens often, the illustration you gave, that you don't feel genuinely that this person can bring it over the finish line. You know, there are many people in life, they have great ideas, great connections, but they can't close deals. So if you genuinely feel that way, then of course it's completely imputer because the whole objective is to get the thing done. But you have to be very honest with yourself, not to try to deprive the maskil with it. Again, it's all, you have to be very, very honest with yourself when you do it. And in many cases, we definitely need somebody to come in and help.
And if this would happen, then we would refer back to what you were discussing before. Where was the cutoff? Meaning, was the person just a maschil? Was he an emtzai? Did he get to the middle of the negotiations?
Right. No, if he's a maschil, he doesn't lose his haschal.
So he gets his third.
Right, but the question is, if he's capable of if he really genuinely is capable of taking this to the finish line, and you just decide you want to give someone else, that's not correct behavior. So yeah, that's what I mean, yes. But of course, you can't eradicate what he already did.
Right, we're going to go look at the scale of where his
exactly
we're
correct.
To figure out
exactly correct.
Okay, very good. Well, tell us an interesting shaila that has
okay,
come
so
by.
Okay, so I'll be honest with you, we've had a lot of cases with Mitaveich, a lot of broker cases. I haven't had any Shidduch cases, but I will tell you a story. I hope it's not true, but my Adam told it to me when he was learning by Rav Elia Baruch in the mirror. This is what happened. In a European country, which shall not be named, there was a Shidduch made, but not a Shidduch made, proposed, and everything was going great. And all of a sudden, the Shachin gets a call from, shall we say, someone that's a larger, a bigger bank account, and it would be a much bigger success for him if he would...
For the Shadchan would get paid.
Right, right. So he told both sides each that it's Gatenish, it's over. That's what he did. So listen to this. So apparently these two families davened in the same shul, one davened at the earlier minyan and one davened at the later minyan. And the one is leaving the earlier minyan. They walk by each other and one turns and goes, listen, you don't want to make a shidduch with me. I understand, but a good Shabbos?
Oh, the parents of the boy and the girl.
Right, so one said to the other.
That said no.
Yeah, they said, okay, you don't want to make a shidduch, I got it, but you can't say a good Shabbos. And the guy said, what are you talking about? You broke it off. Then they figured out what happened. And Baruch Hashem, the shidduch went through. Now, what do you think happened now?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
This is ugly.
Yeah, so guess what happened?
The got thrown out of town.
No, he didn't get thrown
out. Oh, so they're not paying the Shabbos.
He went and demanded the Shadchan's geld. He started the shidduch.
The shadchan demand.
Right, just like chazon ishir of chutzpah. I don't know exactly. That's why I'm hoping it's not true, but apparently it is true. And apparently this was the hak, as they call it, throughout. I don't see any tzad that he's entitled to shadchanis. First of all.
The mastil, maybe.
No, not even the mastil. Think about it. If it's poyol, he was mishan in the shlichus. So he's out. If it's yoyred, he tried to eradicate the whole thing. The Erech Shai brings down that a guy made a shidduch, and then the fellow married somebody else who was a get, and now he went back to the first girl, and he went to Chatz Kronos Kelter. He said, come on, you're Mayayish, at some point you're Mayayish, when he got married to somebody else. Here it's even worse.
He said no. He said no to both sides.
No, yeah, he told them, no, he tried to be like the whole thing. It's a magic. He tried to uproot the trees that he planted in the field. So there's no question there was another story I saw also. A boy, by, I don't know, changing his inflection in his voice, was Meshadach himself. He acted as the shadchan, and he had a temerity. He was going to ask for the shadchan discount from his prospective in-laws. So he's what we call a bal dover. He's not. If a bal dover is somebody that has a achrayus for the shidduch, like a father or a mother or a brother of a yisoimo, and certainly the chassan himself is a bal dover. So obviously he was not entitled to the money. This is from, I think, Rav Zilberstein's stories. I'm not sure how many of them are just shashuei Torah or they actually are real. But clearly he would not be deserving of any type of compensation in such a case.
I can't imagine the father-in-law would want him as a son-in-law.
I think what I read was he was advised to not ask for the money wisely. Otherwise, the shidduch would have been probably over. It depends on the father. Maybe he would admire it. You never know, right? Some people admire assertiveness. Yeah.
Rabbi Shon, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Really entertaining and fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's great to see you again.
You as well. Thank you.
Okay, Zayge Bench.
Thank you so much.
Joining us now are two veteran shadchanim. We have Mrs. Miriam Levitan from Eretz Yisrael. Mrs. Levitan, really appreciate your joining the show today.
My pleasure to be on again. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you as well. And also joining us, Shlomo, the first time we've got to meet and speak, Mr. Shlomo Lewinstein from Lakewood, United States of America. Shlomo, pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward.
It's a pleasure. Okay, I have three stated goals for these interviews. Number one is to learn about the shidduch process. So that's the simplest thing that we definitively will accomplish, Amir Tzashem. Number two is also understanding the differences between different processes, procedures, minhagim, we can call it, in the U.S. versus Israel. So we have all representation from both locations, and that's great. And number three is to assist amateur shadchanim, to give them advice. What are the biggest challenges, and what are the eitzas that you have from them? So I'd love to be able to accomplish all three goals as we get through this. So why don't we start out with Mrs. Levitan? We'll start at the beginning. You're about to set up a boy or girl. You're thinking about it. How much do you need to know? Maybe you don't need to know. How much should you know about each of the boy and the girl and what they are looking for in order to set them up?
Okay, so nowadays most people make a resume, and the basic information that is needed just to get started, you know, name, parents' names, where you're from, what you do, is usually all in the resume, what we call the dry information. What I need to know is I like meeting the candidates so that I can know who they are, their hashkafa, their personality, their style, and the type. In Israel, the word is signon. And it's a very important part of just being able to match the right type with the right type. People want to know when they meet the first time that you've actually thought about who they are and you're coming up with something that makes sense to them as well.
So the basics and the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Very good. Shlomo, how about you?
So I would say I'm pretty much the same. You know, I meet everybody, whether it's the boys or the girls. I meet them. Usually my meetings are pretty brief. I would say it could be as little as 5 minutes. Sometimes it's longer. And by meeting, I get to see, you know, what type they are, you know, which, let's call it, which level of yeshivish. Are they personality, like basics, or more with it, a little more quiet? Like, you know, I don't really get to know people extremely well. Also, family. I deal with a lot of the younger people, the ones I would say from, you know, girls from the age of 19, you know, till 25, 26, 27, where, but even more the younger ages, where a lot of the, a lot of the shidduch revolves around, you know, the basics, the type of person and the family. And, you know, sometimes you have a boy that's looking for a Rebbe's daughter or a more, you know, working type family. So I don't have to know the people intimately and, you know, in depth, that they figure out when they date, if they're compatible, you know, so you don't have to know that much. You know, sometimes I get, if I set someone up a few times, I get to know them better because I hear feedback and that type of thing. But
right. Yeah, so hopefully it doesn't happen. Hopefully it doesn't have to go for too long, but certainly that is going to happen. So Shlomo, let me ask you, somebody tells you, I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. Let's say it's a girl. She says, I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. You meet a boy and he has X and Y, but really not Z. So how much do you have to adhere to the specifications of what each side is looking for? Or can you be a little bit flexible in when you're setting them up and maybe don't accentuate when you're missing the Z or part of the Z?
So it depends what the Z is, you know, like if it's a, you know, for example, if a girl says, I want a guy to learn for 10 years, is such a type, and the boy is going to go to work after 2-3 years, that Z is a big factor. But if it's like, I want someone that's more outgoing, or I want someone that's any specifications which has to do with the in-depth personality, like you know, those type of things, like I don't necessarily listen to. I don't even pay close attention always, because you know, when two people meet, you never know what's going to click. You know, so like I said before, the basics, the type, the learning type, the type family, and that's pretty much it.
Fundamentals. And how about you, Mrs. Levitan?
So it's not a shopping list. So what, when they have a whole list of things, it's not really real. It's very much what Rabbi Lowenstein said. It's the basic hashkafa personality, not the details, the basic personality, the basic hashkafa, the basic person, who they are, what they're looking for, you do need to adhere to, because otherwise you're just wasting people's time. But the nitty gritty, it's not that important, because everyone's a package. No one is a list of things. People are all made up of many different things, and you're not going to find the exact list that you think you need. It's not really realistic. It's not a person. It's things that may or may not be good for them. So it's not that relevant.
Okay, so you've matched the fundamentals, the key components that they're looking for. You think you have a match, boy and girl. Mrs. Levitan, how do you approach each side? What do you say? What information do you give? Do you give the X and Y and not the Z? Or do you give the Z? You say maybe it's a little bit, you have to be a little bit flexible at this point. And which side do you go to first, boy or girl?
Okay, so it's nahug, it's definitely minag of our, you know, all of us to go to the boy side first, unless the girl has specified that she wants to hear first. There are certain families that you're not allowed to give their name unless they've heard first. So I could respect that. But usually you go to the boy first. If they're basically interested, boys usually have lists. So you need to know that they're going to be basically interested in looking into the girl. Then I usually go to the girl as well, just to make sure she's available to be looked into. And I let them also do what we call in Israel, birul rishoni. It's just like an initial phone call. See if it's at all what I'm looking for. Maybe I know this family and I'm totally not interested. Tell them not to look into me. So I like going to both sides, but after the boy has shown interest. That's usually how it's done.
Okay, very good. And Shlomo, same in the United States, or is it different? Yes. There?
Yeah, same thing. You know, usually, like Ms. Levitan said, boys have lists. You know, some have longer lists than others, but so the key is try to get it rolling with a yes from the boy. So most of the times, the girl's family doesn't even know about it until the boy said yes. You know, sometimes, like Ms. Levitan said, the boy's family asks, could you run it by the girl's family to see if they would be, if this is something that interests them, and they do like a brief checking. But that's sometimes the case. You know, there are a few people that, you know, because for whatever reason, the girl's family is very, very selective. So then I may, you know, run it by them first because I don't want to waste anyone's time.
Right. That makes sense. Shlomo, when you're dealing with the sides, are you typically dealing directly with the boy and the girl, their parents? Does it depend on the situation? Does it depend on the age or something like that?
Yeah. Most of the times it depends on the age, like the younger ones in the first couple of years of Shidduchim. The parents are the ones that I deal with. Once the shidduch starts, it's very helpful for me to speak to the boy directly. It would also be helpful sometimes to speak to the girl directly, but, you know, because I'm a man, they may not feel comfortable with that. So, you know, sometimes if I know the family well, so I get to speak to the girl. But, you know, in order to be more useful and be able to coach them properly, it does help to speak direct. Now, the ones that are in Shidduchim for a few years, like an older boy, a lot of times they call their own shots. The mother is already not involved anymore. So then I speak to the boy direct. You know, by the girls, it's almost always with the parents.
The parents. And Mrs. Levitan, is that your experience as well? Or maybe because you're female, you're dealing more with the girls and less with the guys?
No, it depends at what stage of the shidduch. Initially, it's always the parents. We don't approach girls directly, or boys for that matter, especially as Rabbi Lewinstein said, the younger people for sure not when they're starting out. Once the shidduch gets going, I do feel a need to speak directly to the boys and the girls, just because I like hearing their voices and their feedback directly. I find that when I hear it from the parent, it's their coloring, they're giving me feedback. Yeah, everything's great. Everything's going really well. And then I said, can I speak to your daughter? And the girl got on and was like, well, I don't really like the way he looks, and certain parts of his personality really annoy me, but I'll go again. Now, that was a very different feedback. Or the opposite, where the mother's saying, yeah, everything's okay. And then the girl's like really excited. So I need to know that she's really excited, and maybe the boy's not, then I need to kind of know how to pull it off. So hearing the candidates directly gives me insight into where they're holding, what they're feeling, and what's really going on in the shidduch. And it's really crucial.
Okay, very interesting. It may be a touchy subject now, but money. When is money discussed? Is money discussed? When is money discussed? If it is it through the shadchan? Is it directly? And what are the issues and discussions typically that are discussed? So, Mrs. Levitan, why don't we start with you? I'm very interested to hear the difference between Eretz Yisrael. Maybe there's no difference, but I would think maybe there is Eretz Yisrael and Lakewood. So we'll start with Eretz Yisrael, and then we'll go on to Lakewood.
So in Eretz Yisrael, there's money gets discussed before the couples go out, especially if the boy's a long-term learner. It's a big part of the shidduch process. The money that gets discussed is usually towards buying a dira. In Eretz Yisrael, long-term learners usually get money towards the dira in order to ease them into staying into learning longer, as there are no long-term rental units here. So just to set them up for success. And it's usually done through the shadchan. The initial, at least the basic amounts. Sometimes parents really feel strongly that they want to meet directly, so they'll ask for a meeting. They'll say, we'd like to discuss it directly before they go out, and then they actually sit and meet directly. But most of the time it's through the shadchan, and yes, so the money towards the dira is discussed. That's the main discussion.
And what are the going rates? Let me just find that out.
Well, we did a whole show on this with Rabbi Lichtenstein about 5 years ago.
And it was fantastic.
It was quite controversial.
I guess inflation has kicked in since then.
Inflation kicked in. Look, basically, you know, a $500,000 is the basic starting point for anyone who's serious about having a learner altogether. You know, again, depending on which yeshiva and where the boy, you know, when he's just starting out, you know, 600,000-800,000 is totally normal. Even $1 million shekel today is considered a normal amount to be asking. That's really what's going on.
Right. And Shlomo, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Hey,
the job
ironic.
Of the girl is a big factor here. The girl's job.
The girl's job also, how much she can bring in to support the family.
Exactly. It's a big factor. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Shlomo, Lakewood.
Yes. It's very ironic. You know, when I hear this, I've heard this from people that I know in Israel that, you know, a boy has like a price tag based on which yeshiva he learned in. In America, I would say it works the other way around, believe it or not. The less of a learner it is, the more probable and I'm not necessarily talking about support, even though that's a factor, but the better boys. You know, in America, there's all kinds of families. There's, you know, balabatim, people that are working, and there's different levels of balabatim. You know, there's people that are comfortable, and there's, you know, there's wealthy people. And most of the mitzuyonim wind up marrying rabbeim's children or Rosh Yeshiva's child or a father that's learning. That's where most of the mitzuyonim wind up. because they want to be in that environment. They want such a father-in-law. They want such an environment. So it turns out that the Mitzuyonim, the ones that are really, really good, that will probably be in learning for the rest of their lives, wind up, although they get a certain amount of support, but they're getting less than the more mediocre or less than mediocre boys who marry Balabatim. Now, of course, there are chashuva people that are Balabatim that want a top learner too. Of course, that exists. But I'm just talking about in general. If you have, let's say, 50 Mitzionim in BMG right now, let's say, 40 of them are going to marry Rabbeim's daughters, you know, and get less support. Now, the money is, you know, some people discuss it before. Some people discuss it before through the Shadchan. And I think most times people don't discuss it because they know what they're getting into. You know, they know this is a Rebbe's family. We're probably going to get about $1,500 a month for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. The ones that are marrying a balabas that's comfortable, they know they're probably getting $2,500 a month. And the ones that are marrying very well-to-do, they don't even discuss it. It's like goes, you know, this, like maybe the parents discuss it once they meet, you know, by the end. And a lot of times in those shidduchim, the boys' family participates significantly. You know, they give nice support also if they're also comfortable people. So, you know, it's a whole different system in America. So a lot of times people call me and they say, my son is a Mitzuyan. What kind of support could I get? Or the other way around, my daughter's looking for a Mitzuyan. What kind of support will I have to give? And the answer to that is, just because someone's a Mitzuyan doesn't mean you're paying more for that. You know, it usually works the other way around.
That is those are fascinating differences. Not only one, those are multiple fascinating differences between Eretz Yisrael. And should I be saying Lakewood, or is that more Lakewood, Muncie and areas around there? I would think it's more than just Lakewood.
It's all over. Yeah, I mean, Lakewood is where the yeshiva is, but there's, you know, and today, most, you know, Lakewood is so big, that's where most people, you know, it's a big chunk of Klal Yisrael, but we're talking about the whole United States, Montreal, Toronto.
You know, Shlomo, when you started talking, I thought you were going to say that there's a dramatic difference between Israel and Lakewood, because in Israel, you have it based on the yeshiva you went to and this and that. And in Lakewood, there's only one. And in the United States, there's only one yeshiva. I thought you were going to say that, but that would slight all the other beautiful yeshivas that they have in the United States. And we are certainly including them in this show as well. So Shlomo, next question for you, and this is more of a technical question. The first date, second date, third date, where should they go? And also, how long should the dates be? Are there set times that they should stay out for, or is that the subjective thing based on how it's going?
So the first and second dates are usually in the lounge. You know, in America, I think in Israel, there's a concept of meeting in the lounge. In America, most of the times, the boy picks her up in her house and they drive together. I think the reason for that is because everybody lives in an apartment building in Israel, so you can't, you know, have the whole building seeing. I assume that's why. In America,
not everyone has cars. Very few people have cars.
Right.
You're going to take the bus together. You're going to take the bus. Very, very romantic.
Right. So usually the first two are, you know, he picks her up in the house, they go to a lounge. The first two dates are usually around 3 hours from beginning to end, you know, from the time he picks her up till he drops her off. I would say by the third date, sometimes, you know, in the winter, it's harder to find something, but there's places you could walk around a little bit, you know, to be able to bring it to another level. And, you know, lounge gets boring also, just sitting across from each other the whole time. I'd say the third date maybe increases, you know, to 3.5 hours, but that's around the general time.
Right. And Mrs. Levitan in Israel?
So in Israel, the first date is usually in a lounge, hotel lobby, we call it here. Often it's actually in the girls' home. In the firmer, more yeshiva circles, the boy comes to the girls' home and they sit in. That's very common here, believe it or not. It still happens, yes.
Are the parents there, or the parents step aside?
Go to a back room or an upstairs room, and you know, and they sometimes do it in the young couple's apartment, and the young couple's in a back room. It's very, very common. The reason is actually actually a very good one, because a first date should be in a quiet place where people can just get comfortable. A first date is just for getting acquainted. In Eretz Yisrael, a first date's an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours tops. It's you don't really know what the other person is feeling, so you don't want to keep them out too long. We tell people an hour and a half, 2 hours tops, you know, end the date, and a quiet place, quiet, getting acquainted, keep it light. That's what it looks like. The second date is already a little longer, you know, 2 to 3 hours, getting to know each other more. It's usually also in a hotel lobby. From the third date on, it's walking in parks, you know, going to, you know, the harbor, is you know, Tel Aviv Harbor, or just any park, any museum, more walking around and doing different things together. So, and then we don't put a time limit anymore.
And then they take it from there.
Yeah, they see how long they enjoy themselves. Mm-hmm.
Now, Mrs. Levitt, in how much time should the boy and the girl get back to the shadchan to say thumbs up or I'm not interested in continuing? Or a third option is I have concerns and let's see if we can address it. What's the time period that they get back to you in?
Okay, so the first date, it should be pretty soon after the date. As soon as you have an answer, give an answer to a shadchan. If you see you're going to take more time than is normal, at least let the shadchan know you're thinking and you'll have an answer tomorrow by noon or whenever you think you'll have the answer. Silence is the most inappropriate and hardest way to go. So be in touch, even if you don't have an answer, and let the other side know.
And Shlomo?
Yeah, I agree with her, especially after the first date. You know, there's not much to think about. It's either good, bad, or medium. But even if it's medium, usually you go again, you know, if it's medium. Same thing, I would say, if you need to think for whatever reason, even though I don't know, you know, not much to think about, really, after the first. But if you need a little time, it's nice to touch base with the shadchan. Some people get back that evening, the evening of the date, or next thing in the morning. What I always think is a good thing. You know, it's a useful thing. You know, people sometimes give excuses. You know, my daughter came home late from the date. We were already sleeping. And by the time, you know, we woke up early in the morning, we went to work and we didn't see her, and we'll have an answer for you in the afternoon. That happens sometimes. I think it's important before the date, before you go on a date, try to figure out a way that you're going to have time to discuss the date. 5 minutes, you know, I understand if it's after a fifth or sixth date that 5 minutes is not going to cut it. But for the first couple of dates, try to make sure that you come, that you have a plan beforehand of when you're going to talk, you know, because it could really derail a shidduch when the other side doesn't hear back and it makes the other person lose interest. I've seen that happen many times.
It's an indication of being inconsiderate as well. I mean, that's the most important thing, being considerate to the other side.
Right. And a little yush, you know, you start thinking, okay, they're not interested. And in your mind, you go on the next date and you're not all there because you didn't feel that the other person was interested.
Right, right.
Totally agree with that. Got to be a mensch. Yes. Okay, there's two people involved. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's what marriage is about. This is the cocoon to show whether it's going to work or not. So Shlomo, this is maybe more of a difficult question, not such a technical question. When one of the sides has reservations, you mentioned it's a good, bad, or medium. So I guess we're talking in the medium. One of the sides has reservations. Do you ask, what are the reservations? How do you know whether to push them? If they're on the border, they're deciding, borderline, should I go out? Should I not go out? How do you get a sense of whether you should say you really should go out, or you say, okay, not a problem? How can you tell if there's potential or not?
It's a hard question to answer because there's obviously many cases. And first of all, as far as getting feedback, it is useful. Like if someone says, I have a reservation, so if they decide they're not interested, then, you know, it's fine. I don't need to know why. You know, that's their business. But if they're going to continue the shidduch, if they express to me that they have concerns, it's sometimes useful to know. If someone doesn't like the way the other person looks, for example, it's not going to help to share it with me because there's nothing the other person could do. But if it's a, you know, the person was quiet, the person didn't ask me questions, he wasn't listening properly, he was playing with his straw, anything that that gets any silly thing that, or not silly, but anything that could be fixed up is definitely kedai. Because just because someone didn't ask questions doesn't mean he's not interested. It just means that he's maybe not a seasoned dater, or, you know, he was nervous or anything like that. So it's definitely, I definitely like to get feedback if they're going to continue. Now, when do I know whether to push or not? Each case is different. And I, you know, it also depends on the person. If it's a person that's dated a lot and I can see where this is heading, you know, then I don't push, even though you would think the other way, let's just push them to get married. But if it's like, okay, here we go again, then I wouldn't encourage. If it's somebody that I feel has like a, you know, I sense potential with a reservation, then I may encourage them to continue.
That's very subjective. It's a very subjective, it's difficult to give clarity. Mrs. Levitan, what are your thoughts on this question?
Yeah, I totally agree. Although when in doubt, go out is definitely a motto I use. Again, it depends on the situation and the person and what I know about them. I definitely ask for feedback because I find it very helpful to get to know the person and to understand how to navigate the shidduch. As Rabbi Lewenstein said, you know, if he or she was doing something that can be fixed, so it's worth knowing. And people are always nervous. If I tell the shatran, then she's going to tell him, and then I won't really be seeing him. And the answer to this, and it's very important, is that a shatran is not going to change someone by giving them one line of feedback. Halavai, it would be that easy to change people. So if someone's nervously, as he said, flicking his straw or, you know, not making eye contact, he needs to learn how to date. If a guy didn't buy a drink or didn't... you know, tip the waiter properly, whatever, that's more of a red flag. But maybe he just forgot or he didn't know. So let's hear about it. Let's hear his side. And let's not nix the shidduch over something that may be technical and may not necessarily. Also, if one side, sure, I would encourage the other side, because there's probably a little more potential there than they're willing to admit to. Sometimes they're just scared or they're, you know, not giving it a real chance. What I find today is that girls after date one or two are already thinking, am I going to marry this guy? And it's not a way to date. You need to get to know someone before you know the answer to whether you can marry them. And girls come back from a first date and will tell me, I don't think I'm going to marry him, so I think I'll end it. What do you know after an hour and a half whether you're going to marry someone? That's not the way to date. It's a process. And that's an important message to get out there. You have to go through the process. You have to get to know the person. And then you make a decision whether to get married or not. And that's why the feedback is so crucial. What are they really thinking? Are they thinking they're getting married after an hour? Or is there really something disturbing them? So that's why we need feedback.
So should they be thinking not, do I want to marry this person? Or should they be thinking, do I want to date this person another time?
Correct. Do I want to get to know them more is the question after each date. And then how much more do I know and how much more do I need to know? Where am I holding in the process?
Right. And Mrs. Levitan, what's your take on giving feedback to both sides along the way? How is it going? What are the thoughts? What are the concerns? Or it's just yes, no, and keep it going?
No, everyone should have feedback so that they know where they stand. Feedback is something that it's a delicate part of the process. And that's why, as we get to the amateur shatran here, it doesn't always know. Any feedback we have should be given in a positive light. So you have to think of a positive way to give it over so that the person doesn't feel criticized or attacked and that they feel like they're being helped. And it doesn't always have to feel like it's coming from the other side. You can just say it from your own. Like in general, I tell people at the stage two, you know, whatever it is to, you know, make sure they're really listening before they answer or to make good eye contact. You know, you just had initial dates. Now you're getting more serious. Make sure you're really hearing her and answering her question and, you know, giving her the real attention that the question or the discussion deserves. So it doesn't have to be direct. She said, you said, it's a chachma, what to give over, how to give it over in a positive way to really help them through the process.
To facilitate yes and positivity as opposed to negativity.
Correct. No one wants to be criticized. That's just not, it's not helpful to be criticized.
It's not going to get you on the next date. It's not going to work. And Shlomo, I'd love to hear your input on this one.
She's saying very good. It's, you know, if you tell the other person feedback with five complaints, You know, the girl says you weren't looking at her. The girl said you weren't asking questions. She complained that you didn't buy her a drink. You know, the guy's going to like, you know, he's not going to feel good about himself. He's not going to feel good where he stands in the shidduch. So if there's criticism, you know, put a positive spin on it and try to make it coming not from the other side. Like give the person encouragement and direction, but not in a way where it's coming with criticism, because you could derail the shidduch if you do that.
Right. Just how you speak, how the shadchan speaks could be positive or negative. Right. So Shlomo, you said it could be yes, no, or medium. So let's say you get a no from one side. It could be on the first date, second date, third date, fourth date, whatever it is. How do you inform in a positive fashion, I would think, but how do you inform the other side that he or she is not interested in continuing? As nice as you say it, it's a rejection. It's a no. And also, a second question, maybe it's a related question, but maybe it should be a separate question. If they say, what's the reason? I was really into this. I was so positive about this. I was optimistic about this. Why doesn't he want to go out again? Do you give the reason or not?
It's obviously, you always try to make people feel good. So even if I don't hear it from the one that's saying no, I might put it in myself. You know, like I say, Reuven saw, beautiful things and he sees what a good girl she is, but he just doesn't see it, you know. You always try to make the person feel good and that the other person saw the milus. As far as giving reasons, it depends what the reasons are. You know, like if it's going to be an insult, I try to avoid that. You know, I may not even know the reason. You know, a lot of times someone says no, and if it's early on in the shidduch, if it's after one or two or even three dates, I may not ask. It's just a feeling. I don't see myself with that person. So I may not ask, but it depends what they tell me. If they tell me something which is going to be insulting, I try to avoid that. I just say that, you know, Reuven saw beautiful Milas, but just doesn't see this going. You know, that's I try to give a vague general answer. If there was something, you know, she's too outgoing, something which isn't an insult, she's too yeshivish for me, that's not an insult, you know, those type of things, or I may say if I get that from her.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Levitan, love to get your input on this one.
Yeah, very much similar. You have to be very empathetic when you're giving a rejection. Be there with the person, feel their pain, and give it over nicely. As Rabbi Lewinstein said, yes, give it over with a compliment. Yes, you he saw your milas, she saw your milas, you're a great person. This is not about who you are. This is just about it's not compatible. So there's definitely a way to give it over. When you hear something real and honest in a rejection, it helps you to get over it. Yes, I'm too yeshivish, or I'm, too bubbly for him. He needs a quieter girl, looking for a different type. It was great knowing this person, but the connection just didn't come. That's also fine. You know, at least the person knows what happened, and it helps them move forward. It is validating, and it does help get over the pain of rejection.
Brings closure.
Right.
Doesn't always work, because if someone is like has gone out 5, 6, 7, 8 times, then you can't get away with like out saying something. You gotta try to give the other person, because then it was like a whole relationship. It took there was a lot going on here just to say I don't have any reason. You know, just you gotta give more. Sometimes it depends on the case, but in those cases, you may have to. Say something that may be a drop critical, because it's harder to get over it when you have no idea what happened.
Especially when it comes from left field. Maybe there were issues along the way, so you know it's coming, but if it was all good, going strong, and then it comes from left field that it's a no, then that's going to be a difficult no to be a recipient of. Right, that makes sense. Ultimately, we want to give eitzas to the shadchanim out there, the amateur shadchanim, people who are trying to set up, and it's such a tremendous mitzvah. You know a boy, you know a girl, and you want to set them up, and you're not a verderer, and you don't have a lot of experience. So Mrs. Levitan, what issue do you think is going to be the most challenging for an amateur shadchan, and what would you say they should do in order to deal with that specific issue?
Okay, so I'm going to start by saying they should reach out to veteran shadchanim to ask for hadracha. We're happy to give it to them. It's a lot easier to direct it and help the amateur shadchan than to take over when things have been messed up. Let's just say it as it is. One big piece of advice is that amateur shadchanim, and this is a positive thing, get very excited about their shidduchim. They get very personally involved, and it creates a certain pressure on their friend who they're usually setting up. And it usually derails the shidduch in the end. So one big piece of advice for people who like getting involved, take yourself out of it. This is about your friend or the person, your acquaintance, whoever you're setting up. It's about them. Listen to them. It's about them. It's not about you and your excitement and making a shidduch. And it's even for veteran shadchanim, we also have to remember that. It's not about us. This is about the other person. And we have to give them their space and their respect and hear them and listen to them and direct them properly and not give them over our excitement, which has no part in the shidduch.
That's a message for so many other issues, not just shidduchim, but relationships and marriage and raising kids and so many other things. So thank you for that. Reb Shlomo, what would you say is the biggest challenge that an amateur shadchan is going to encounter? And what would you say to them, how to deal with that challenge?
So, you know, Mr. Levitan brought up a very good point. So first of all, how to navigate the shidduch. It is a beautiful program that got started a few months ago in Lakewood. It's called Newly Reds. It was founded by Rabbi Levy, who's a veteran shadchan here. The Newly Reds is young couples and even older couples come up with ideas, but they feel they can't navigate the shidduch. So they send in the idea to the Newly Reds website. I don't know exactly how it works, but the ideas get sifted by veteran shadchanim that know maybe some ideas are not good, some ideas are good, and the ideas get sent to a bunch of shadchanim, and anyone can pick, I want to read this one, I'm going to read this. You know, I get emails every few days with some of the ideas. In fact, tonight I have a couple going out. It was not my idea. It was, I saw it on the Newly Reds thing and I said, I'll take this one, and they're going out. We'll see what happens. But so that's not a bad thing. If a couple feels like they have good ideas, but they just don't feel they could do it, you know, do it with Newly Reds, or you could ask a veteran shadchan to do it. If someone wants to do it themselves, you know, get hadracha from someone that knows, like, you know, don't, like Ms. Levitan said, it's very important to take yourself out of the, you're not, you know, you want to make a shidduch, it's very nice, but, you know, you got to make sure that it's the right shidduch and that the two parties are interested and they want each other. So no pushing, take yourself out of it. And, sometimes young people get emotionally involved. This is like their shidduch, they're so excited and they just can't get over the, they mismanage it because of their enthusiasm to make a shidduch. So you got to make sure that doesn't happen. So yeah, that's basically it. And if you have any questions along the way, I have people call me all the time. If I could get to it, I try to help.
It also sounds like from both of what you're saying that veteran shadchanim are happy not only to help, but to get involved if there's a shidduch that's looking good and an amateur is having a difficult time managing it. Just punt it over to a veteran and get them involved and help the process. It sounds like that's a wise thing to do. So my push would be amateurs, go for it and set up those shidduchim as much as possible and get assistance. Get assistance. Ultimately, it's about setting up beautiful couples together and setting up and hopefully to reach marriages and whatever efforts are necessary. Get Klal Yisrael involved in helping whatever is necessary to get that shidduch done in a beautiful way. If I can end off asking each of you your best advice, one piece of advice for somebody, an amateur, shadchan, somebody who's setting up a friend, a cousin, a relative, what would you say is something critical to keep in mind? Who are we going to start with? Mrs. Levitan, why don't we start with you?
Critical to keep in mind is obviously the compatibility of the two people involved. Are they actually compatible with each other? Just because you know both and you like both doesn't make it a compatible shidduch. You know, see if it really is compatible. And again, as we said, get the right advice on how to go about it and how to navigate it. And when you feel it's too much, hand it over. sometimes the finances get too much. Sometimes just speaking to one mother or the other is over the top. So give it over and let someone else run it. It will always be a shidduch. We don't need the extra glory of another shidduch, Baruch Hashem. We don't need it. But if they need it, we're happy to give them all the glory, but let's run the shidduch properly, because the goal in the end of the day is to get people married, not to put another feather in our caps.
Right. And Shlomo, how about you?
Yeah, she's saying very good. I would say, you know, listen out. If someone wants to make a shidduch, just because you know a boy and a girl, and it seems like, you know, they're both Shem and Shabbos, that's not good enough. You know, you got to listen out for what they want, not what you want. You got to listen out what they want, and based on that, read the shidduch. If you feel you could run it yourself, go for it. If you feel you need help, then give it over to someone else. I want to add another beautiful point about this Newly Reds program. May Levy worked very hard on it. He got sponsors. I don't know all the details, but he got a couple that gets a shidduch set up, like the couple that I have going out tonight. I don't even know whose idea it was, but that couple will be getting a prize just for setting up this date. Maybe it's a dinner for two in a restaurant or such a type of prize, but it's really a beautiful push, and it's great the sponsors are sponsoring this, because I think they've had a few successes already. So
amazing. Yes. So whoever is funding that, yeshar koach to you. It's a great effort. And we should start other efforts like that, getting everyone to set up shiduchim in Klal Yisrael. It's so badly needed. And everyone knows people. Everyone knows people. And it's just a wonderful thing to do, a tremendous mitzvah. So the more we can do this, the better it's going to be. I want to thank both of you for joining us. I had a good time. This was very educational and very interesting. And I really appreciate it. I want to do this again. So really, thank you for joining us. And I look forward to next time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining us now is David Katzoff. David is a survey statistician by trade. That means he is a statistician. David, that's even a hard word to say, but a statistician for surveys, that's fairly technical and interesting. But he spends much of his free time involved in assisting single men and single women, including being a volunteer shadchan. David, yeshar koach for doing that. And thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure. So, David, walk us through. I understand you've been doing this for a while. It's not just a few months. When did you set up your first couple? When did you start doing that? And what inspired you to start making matches between people?
So I've been a volunteer matchmaker for the past 27 years. I started dating when I was 22 years old. And shortly after I started dating, I started setting up others on dates. What got me into it was, when I wanted to start dating, I reached out to several local rabbeim and shadchanim. I was asking for assistance. At the time, I was going for my MBA, and I was learning a couple of times at night, and I wasn't getting set up much. There wasn't many dating ideas coming my way, and it was getting frustrating. And it felt to me at that time, and I still feel the same way now, that because I wasn't yeshivish and I wasn't connected to a yeshiva, I just wasn't a priority. And I felt that because the shidduch system is primarily set up to help out one segment, and that is young yeshivish men, which I was not. So my feeling at the time is that if I'm that frustrated at 22, I can imagine how much more frustrating it is for people that are older than me. So I decided I want to be part of the solution, and I started setting up women that I had dated with my friends. And by age 25, I had already set up 25 pairs of people on dates.
That's amazing. So, David, in other words, you went out with a young woman, and if it wouldn't work out, you started thinking, I have plenty of friends, maybe somebody would be appropriate for you, and you set them up based on knowing both of them at that point.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I'm a statistician, so my thinking at the time was, if I have 20 single male friends and I dated 20 women, that's 400 possible ideas. So I would just think of potential ideas that made sense. And then I would present the idea to them.
It helps to be a statistician, I guess, when it comes to making matches, to be a shadchan. That's great. So, David, walk us through, how many attempts have you made to get people to go out, and how many actually said yes to go out on that first date?
So there's no question that the number of attempts to get to a date has increased over time. I would say at this time, I have set up about 100 pairs of people that agreed to go on a date. And it took about 700 attempts to get there. So on average, about seven. It definitely wasn't that much about 10 years ago. It's definitely increased over time.
And that's a lot of work to try, attempt 700 meaning 700 boys and girls. That's 1,400?
Yes, 700 ideas, dating ideas that I presented to the boy or the girl, the young man or the young woman.
And to have 100 accept, that is tremendous. That's terrific. So what would you say the greatest challenges has been to get them to go on that first date? Date number one, because it went from 700 pairs down to 100 pairs going out.
So in dealing with single men, I think the most likely reason that they are to reject an idea is based on her photo. So I tell them that if you're completely not physically attracted to her, then you shouldn't go out. But if you think that maybe, you know, you're on the fence, then just understand that your physical attraction to someone grows as your relationship grows with her. So why not give it a try? As far as when it comes to single women, they are rejecting ideas for a variety of reasons. You know, one of the main reasons is that the person is not hashkafically compatible, which is a real thing. I mean, there's no question that there are many more women that are seeking a learner-earner guy than there are learner-earner men. So I basically try to just, you know, get them to consider to being a little bit more open-minded on who they're willing to go out with. That's what I try with them.
Very interesting. So it's different things between the men and the women that they're saying no to a first date on.
Yes, yes. And I mean, men are much more likely to be flexible as long as they are attracted to the photo. They're much more likely to be flexible on the other things and go on the first date. You know, women are, you know, flexible on some things, I'm finding. But there are certain things like, you know, having the same hashkafic beliefs and background that they are not as flexible on, I would say.
I think we would get a lot of interesting phone calls if I made a comment about the difference in values and depth of personality between men and women. So we won't go there. So David, the next question then is, what's the greatest challenge in getting them to go out on a second date? If they say yes, both say yes, great. But if one says yes, one says no, and trying to convince them, well, what do you think the breakdown is at that point?
Honestly, if either of them really doesn't want to go on a second date, I don't feel it's my job to persuade them to do otherwise. They're adults. It's their decision. If they're on the fence about it, then I'll have a discussion with them and I'll try to prompt them to consider some different things that they may not have considered. But again, ultimately, it's their decision. I'm here to support them through the process, but they're the ones that are making the ultimate decision of whether to continue dating.
Now that makes sense. That makes sense. So, David, let me ask you, who do you think are the best people to be setting others up? Who, for example, has the best access to friends, to women, young men, or not so young? Who should be doing this? Who should be jumping in and become amateur shadchanim and put in the efforts that you're putting in?
So I do believe that mutual friends who know both parties well are more likely to come up with a good idea. But in general, I do think that a good idea really can come from anyone, whether a single person or a married person. A few years ago, I ran an initiative where I would invite a group of single men and women to my house, and we would go around the room, and each person would have the option of either describing themselves or describing a single friend of theirs. And while they were doing that, everyone else would be thinking for potential ideas for that person being described. So I was trying to get the single men and women to be thinking outside of themselves and using their own network to help out each other. We started with 6 people, it then gone to 9 people, then 15 people. We eventually moved it from Silver Spring, where I live, to Baltimore. By the end, we were actually getting over 20 people. And many dates came out of it, at least 25 dates that I'm aware of, including a marriage, which I'm very proud of. And after I got this started in Maryland, I then reached out to dozens and dozens of shul rabbeim across the country, trying to persuade them to try the same idea in their community. So I was asking them to put me in touch with someone who'd be willing to try the same thing. And I was able to help get a group started in Toronto, Los Angeles, and New York. And in the case of New York and my group, we kept it going for 3 years, and many dates came out of it, and including some marriages.
Hopefully that inspired efforts like this. It doesn't have to be exactly that, but various forms of initiatives and getting singles and others to be setting other people up that they know. That sounds like a tremendous idea.
Yeah, I really think that we need to get as many people as possible to really be thinking about others in terms of helping them through this dating process. So getting more people to be matchmakers really could benefit the whole Jewish community.
Okay, great, great, great. David, you've been doing this a long time. I think you said 27 years, is that correct?
Yes.
Would you say it's more difficult nowadays, over 20 years, you've been doing this over 20 years, 27 years, to get people to go on that first date? And if so, if you think it's more difficult to get yeses from both sides, what do you think has changed?
It's definitely a lot more difficult. And there are a variety of reasons for it. Number one, as I mentioned before, it's a big part of it is the photo. When I started dating, there was some people, a lot of people actually were going on dates without seeing a picture first. It was pretty common. That is not much very common nowadays. So that's stopping a lot of dates right there. Another big issue is that social media is really having a negative impact. It feels like many are using social media to try to find some reason, whatever the reason is, to not go out with somebody. And many times they're able to find whatever they're looking for. The other thing which I think is really having a negative impact is the increase in what I would call hashkafa segmenting. So 20 years ago, most people described themselves as either modern Orthodox or yeshivish or Hasidish. Nowadays, there's many subsegments. So, for example, just within modern Orthodox, you could be modern Orthodox machmir, you could be modern Orthodox middle of the road, you could be modern Orthodox liberal. And it's not just that the labeling makes things more difficult, it's that there really are differences in the way people view things, depending on where they fall in their hashkafa.
So three things: photos, those are killing people going out, not the killing the people, but it's obstructing people going out. Social media, because people are looking for a no, and hashkafa segmenting. So you have to have a direct match. And if we're segmenting smaller and smaller, fewer and fewer people are falling into the buckets, we're going to get fewer yeses because of that.
Exactly.
Okay, interesting. What are the biggest macro challenges you see in setting up shiduchim? More for the system-wide.
So I believe, firmly believe this, that the observant Jewish community has a supply and demand issue. And there are simply not enough observant men who fit the qualities that most women are seeking in a spouse. I've done quantitative analysis based on a survey that was done a couple of years ago, and it shows that right off the bat, more men are going off the derech than women. And on the flip side, there are more women baal shuvas and converts than there are men. So in other words, more men are leaving, more women are coming in. So right off the bat, there's an imbalance. On top of that, I'm also seeing that there are many more men than women who either lack a professional career path, are becoming less observant, not necessarily going completely becoming not observant, but becoming less observant over time. Or there's also more men who need support to develop their social and emotional intelligence. And that's one of the things, the social emotional intelligence is one thing that women really emphasize, that they want someone who has social emotional intelligence. And I think that's something that really more men can use support on.
Very interesting and unfortunate. Very unfortunate. David, you've been doing this a long time. What would you say is the strangest or maybe the most difficult situation you had to deal with as a shadchan?
So unfortunately, over the 27 years, there's been a number of these strange, bizarre cases that I've dealt with. People will be amazed at what happens behind the scenes. The strangest one happened 2 years ago. The mother of a young woman reached out to me asking for assistance for her daughter. And we talked for a while. We had a nice conversation. She told me right off the bat that her daughter doesn't have a shidduch resume because they're a very private family and they're worried that the resume would get into the wrong hands of people that they don't want it to get into their hands. So she told me some basic information about her daughter's mitos. She gave me a couple of references and she sent me a picture of her daughter. Okay. But it felt to me when I started asking more detailed questions that the mother was being very cagey about what information she was willing to provide to me. But I decided, you know, I'll still try to help her out. So I thought of an idea. I send the information to the guy. He did the reference checking. He said yes. She did the reference checking. The other side said yes. They agreed to go out. They lived a couple of states away from each other. So it wasn't, an easy. It was they were a few hours apart from where they lived. But they decided to give it a try. And they had a very nice first phone call. And then I was sitting at the dinner table and I was talking to my wife about this specific situation. And my wife asked, oh, can I see a picture of the young lady? So I showed it to her. And my wife's response was, oh, she's beautiful. She looks like a Disney princess. But my daughter was sitting next to her. And my daughter said, oh, can I see the picture? So she showed her, my daughter, the picture. And she said, Mom, she is a Disney princess. This is an actress who's been on the Disney Channel. I've seen her. I was stunned.
So they they took a picture of a Disney actress and sent that instead of the picture of the daughter?
Yes. Yes. We did investigative work. My daughter knew how to do a Google photo search so that we can see pictures on the internet that resemble the picture that was sent to us. And we were actually able to find the exact picture of this actress who appeared on the Disney Channel. And what made things even worse, not only did the mother send me a fake picture, she actually cropped the picture to make it look like the daughter was dressed in a more sneeze way.
What
I was
floored. What were they thinking? As soon as that date starts, within 2 seconds, he's going to say, this is not the right person. This is Leah, not Rachel.
I agree. It's a good question. To this day, I still don't know. What I did was I immediately reached out to the mother. This was on Thursday night. They're supposed to go out on Saturday night. So I reached out to the mother. I said, your daughter has a striking resemblance to so-and-so actress. Can you please call me? So Thursday night goes by, no response. Friday morning, no response. At this point, I felt I need to tell him. So I reached out to him. I told him the story. Understandably, he decided he does not want to go out with her. And he felt the same way that I did, that even if she resembled exactly the same as the picture, it's still not trusting to do that. So I reached out and I said that he decided he does not want to go out. The mother finally then gets back to me, and I was just asking her again and again, why did you send me this fake picture? And she just kept on dodging the question. And basically, she ended up hanging up on me. I never found out.
Unbelievable story. Wow. Based on that, you know, there are obviously challenges, and it seems that maybe you need some resilience as a shadchan. Do you think everyone can get into this? Amateurs, setting up people, are certain skills necessary? Is this something that we can say to our listeners, please start setting people up, or is that not a wise idea for everyone to get involved in?
As long as a person is sensitive to single men and women, and they really give it thought about when they come up with ideas, then yes, I do think that anyone could be a matchmaker. Again, it does not have to be the perfect idea. If you have some reason that you think that this man and this woman go together, present the idea to them and let them decide. In terms of skills, I think that a matchmaker has to have patience in dealing with single men and women, because there are going to be times that there's going to be frustrating things that are going to happen. They're not going to get back to you for several days at times. You have to have perseverance. Most of your ideas are going to get rejected. Keep on trying. And you have to have positivity. So again, the three P's: patience, perseverance, positivity. Keep on being positive with the single men and women. Their Bashir is out there. It's just a matter of time, between going out and finding the right person.
Very good insights. David, on the macro level, let's go back to the macro conversation. What are your recommendations? You've seen a lot out there. So your recommendations to the challenges that you're seeing in the current shidduch system?
So again, there are many issues in the shidduch system, but again, I do believe that the biggest issue is there's just not enough men to go around that fit the qualities that most women are seeking. I do think that we need to really provide social skills to prepare men and women for when it's time to date. I think mentorship and education are really the key. So mentorship, in terms of when our single men and women are done with their Jewish education and they're off on their own, they left the house, who's looking out for them? Who's mentoring them? Who are their role models? I believe we need to have mentors set up in all the various Jewish communities that have a number of singles there. And their role is to reach out to single men and women and just be there as a support system. Basically help them through the dating process, not necessarily as a matchmaker. I'm talking about just giving advice, helping them when it comes to dating etiquette, helping them in terms of how do you develop a healthier relationship, conflict resolution, etc. But on top of mentorship, I also think that a lot needs to be done during the schooling. So a lot of schools around the country have started doing what's called social emotional learning. And they're doing that for the most part for elementary kids. But I want to see it done a lot more, especially in Jewish schools, for high school kids. There's a lot of things that could be taught during that that would really help them in terms of decision making. It will help them in terms of, you know, again, building their social skills and, you know, helping them for the future when it comes to when they having the right relationship skills when it comes, you know, when they enter the professional world, when they enter the dating world. So I'm hoping that that could really be an emphasis in Jewish schools across the country, to have this, again, social emotional learning.
It sounds very wise, and start young and continuing it through the education. That sounds very wise.
Yeah, I really think that make a big difference. I mean, if there really is not enough men to go around that meet the qualities of women, then having more dating apps and singles events is only going to make a marginal impact. We need to find ways to really increase the amount of marriage material men that meet those, you know, what the qualities that the women are seeking.
Work on the quality. David, I know there's going to be a question on everyone's mind. Maybe it's not an appropriate question, but I'll ask it anyway. You attempted 700 couplings, so 700 pairs, and 100 said yes. How many wound up in marriage?
So I have a 98% success rate. And what I mean by that is 98% of the time, the person, the two people that I set up, either want to go out again or they had a good time. They don't want to go out again necessarily, but they were still very appreciative that I set them up. The number of marriages that come out of it, you know, my efforts resulted in many marriages. But honestly, the actual number doesn't make any difference. It's really about effort. It's really about showing the single men and women that you're thinking about them, that you're trying to help them through the process. That goes a long way. Even when they reject the idea, it still gives them a feedback that there is someone out there that is thinking about me. So I feel that really effort is the key, not the amount of marriages that came out of it.
Right. I would fully agree with that, David. I think that's a very appropriate answer. Everyone should put in the effort. It's not about results. We say the same thing when it comes to Kiruv. It's not a matter of how many people became Shomer Shabbos because of your efforts, but being out there, showing them that you care, showing them that we are putting in efforts on behalf of Klal Yisrael because we have something that is precious and is something that should be offered to every Jew out there. And the results is not something that we should be focused on. The efforts is something that we should be focused on. And that applies in so many areas in life as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I just want to add that there are very few things in life where we can really make an enormous positive impact on someone's life by simply presenting an idea to them. This is one of the ways to do just that. So we really, as a Jewish community, we all need to make the most of this golden opportunity.
Absolutely. David, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I love that you're both a statistician and a shadchan because you look at the numbers, you think about numbers, and you know that with putting in enough effort, at the end of the day, you will have happy people, people that know that you care about them, and that means the world to everyone. So really, congratulations, and you should have a bracha to continue the hatzlacha that you are seeing.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on to discuss this very important topic.
A pleasure. Thank you, David. Joining us now is Mr. and Mrs. Noah and Ruchama Chodansky. Noah Chodansky made Aliyah about 3 years ago. He's currently learning in the Gris Kollel, and Mrs. Chodansky made Aliyah. They're both from South Africa about 4 years ago. They got married a year and a half ago, and I have heard they have tried to make numerous shiduchim with some success. I'm less concerned about the success than the effort, so we'll talk about that. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having us. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited. Thank you.
Terrific. Well, I've heard nice things. We've never spoken before. And I've heard that you are very much involved in Shiduchim after only a year and a half of marriage. I'd love to hear, starting with, how did you get involved in setting up people?
Well, I'll go first and then pass it over to Ruchama. I grew up in South Africa, came to Israel for a year and a half, and then went to YU. And I think I had a lot of background. When I was in YU, I dated people from kind of all different backgrounds, all different, you know, slightly different hashkafas, kind of figuring myself out. And I think when you're at that age, you know, your friends are doing the same. And as you go around the circle, I mean, I was saying to Ruchama before the show, my friend has this great quote that dating is just meeting your friends' wives. So you end up meeting people who, like, you think, oh, Dafka, that could be, you know, a great call with a friend, with someone you know, a little bit older than you, a little bit younger than you, same shir, whatever it is. And just like that, I think I started like matching people up. And definitely when you're married, you have a lot more, I guess, credibility, a lot of people willing to trust you a lot more. So definitely when we got married, that kind of got accelerated and great.
So once you got married, you both got involved in doing it together.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I guess because
Noah, you've got your friends, and Mr. Chodansky, you've got your friends, and you talk over dinner about who may be a match for the other one.
Right. And we also make an effort to try, not just speak about each other, have them over. What Noah and I will often do is, instead of just discussing our friends, we'll often try to get to meet them a little bit. So we'll have some of Noah's friends over sometimes for meals. Sometimes we'll have my friends over. And then you actually both know both sides. And then I feel like it helps a little bit more.
Oh, that's interesting. So how do you divide up the tasks? Does Noah deal with the men and you deal with the women? How does that work?
A lot of the time we spend thinking about it. And so that's obviously equal. That's like discussion. And I think, you know, from my perspective, like, I think maybe I'm not less sensitive, but more like, look, Rukama thinks, Maaf sees things in a different way. She sees things, you know, from a more, sometimes a more emotional way, kind of she sees things in a different way. And hearing her perspective is always like really complimentary. So being able to think through things together is definitely equal. And then after that, yeah, sometimes, you know, she'll reach out to her friends. I'll reach out to my friends. If my friend, you know, wants references and it's really Rufama's friend, sometimes he'll speak directly to Rufama. It kind of depends on the situation. And yeah.
Also, Noah's very good about, he's very muffed. Like at least once a week, he'll come up to me and say, okay, who are we setting up this week? He's really good about being very, like, once a week at least. Yeah.
That is great. So you have like a quota that you need to hit.
Yeah, get that kind of scale.
Yeah, so walk us through. How many couples have you attempted to set up? Married for a year and a half, that's not that long. So how many couples have you attempted to set up? That's the attempts. And how many have actually gone out once? They said yes. She said yes, and he said yes. So two numbers I'm looking for.
Right. So actually, I was thinking about it. We don't usually count. I can say at least more than 100, but we don't usually count how many people we set up a day. But I know today, because I knew that I was going to be speaking to you, I actually checked my messages before I came to speak to you. And today was six people who I reached out to.
Today alone, you reached out to six people.
Yeah. It happened to be we were at a wedding. So often if I see someone at a wedding, I'll say, oh, did you think of anyone? I think that was, it's a large number. It could be less, could be more. It really depends on the day. But just to give everyone a bit of an idea, of the six people, one already said no to two suggestions. One said yes. Most in reply. One requested to go out with someone that he saw at a wedding. And I'd already asked her about a couple months ago, but he doesn't know. Like, I think people don't realize how much goes into it. You only know about the final product. You know when someone actually sends you a suggestion or you say yes. But people don't realize that for each yes, there's so many no's and so many behind the scenes. I think also for single people, I think people have a tendency to feel like other people don't notice them or aren't looking out for them. But just so they know, like, there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that often don't always come into fruition.
How do you keep track of this? Who you spoke to, who you didn't speak to? You have a spreadsheet that you keep track of everything?
Saying we should. Noah thinks it's weird.
We don't have a spreadsheet. We have, listen, a lot of sending the resume is because we're in Israel and our community, we're sending it over WhatsApp. So sometimes we're like, oh, have we suggested that already? And then we go back and look, we usually haven't. I will just say on Rukhama's last point, I think it's really important. We always joke that Shadchanim should get paid for all the couples that they set up once and not the couples that make it. Because often the couples that make it are the easiest work. The couples that make it, like, you set them up on the first date and they hit it off and that's it. And a lot of the time, like, the hardest work is people who go out for 2, 3, 4 months and it doesn't quite cut it. And it's like you spent hours and invested hours and you thought it was good and then it wasn't good and then it was good. There is a lot to be said about, like, actually, what Rukhama said, like, a lot of it's behind the scenes. A lot of it's about behind the scenes.
People often talk about how expensive shadchanim are and you know, why you connect or any of these shadchanim, that just people are so expensive. And something we often discuss is you're not paying for the times that it works. You're actually paying for all those times that it doesn't work. Because people could go out like 6 months and nothing comes of it and you're the in-between. But when it actually works, it's usually really easy. Like Noah said, you just set them up, you know?
Right, absolutely. So walk me through, what's the main reason that either a boy or a girl don't agree to go out the first time? I want to get a sense of what the challenges are, especially because a lot of people are listening and I'm hoping we inspire them to do what you're doing. So is there a specific reason that a boy or a girl say no, or is just across the board?
So sometimes I think it's because they know them, or they think they know them, they've seen them, they think they saw, you know, they saw them at shul and they didn't think they were attractive, or they're friends of their friends and they're friends of their sisters and they think they know them, but they aren't willing to give it a shot. And sometimes it's other things like, you know, we maybe, I wouldn't say sometimes it's things like heart, or it's things like their age, or it's things that I think once you get to know someone can be immaterial, but for some people are just a blocker. And me and Rucham often talk about, like, sometimes we set up people and they didn't ask for the age, and they've messaged us 3 months later saying, wow, like, if I had known she was two years older than me, like, I probably wouldn't have gone out. And, like, I'm really happy you didn't tell me that. Or I didn't know that she was 5'9". I thought she was, I thought she was 5'6". I didn't know she was 5'2". I thought she was 5'7". And the fact that, you didn't tell me that wasn't in the resume, that wasn't in the bio, is actually super helpful.
I'll also add that I've sometimes changed, I've taken people's ages off when I know that maybe she's 1 year older than him or something like that. And I had a case where I took it off and he asked me, the person who I was setting the girl up with, asked me, how old is she? And I said, oh, she's around my age. And that could be anything from 5 years to, I don't know, 10 years to my actual age. Or I'd say context, like, oh, she was with me in STEM. She was with me in whatever context where you know her. So then people assume that they're around the same age. And then I had someone who they went out, I think it was maybe 6 months or something. And he texted me and was like, I just want to let you know, I really appreciate it. I never would have gone out knowing her age. And we've been going out for so long. So I think it is a big component.
And just to add to that, you know, some people like would see that like, oh, you're lying to the person. And sometimes maybe if it really means a lot to the person, it does. But sometimes it's just like people are nervous. People aren't so confident. People don't necessarily want to go out. And like, I wouldn't say looking, but anything that's like a little bit off, anything that's 2 years older, anything that's 2 inches too, you know, not tall enough, it'll say, okay, you know, this isn't the person. And chaval, like that's not true most of the time. We all know people, tons of people who've married someone older than them, married someone taller than them, married someone, you know, who looked better in person, they did in a photo, stuff like this. And I think just the other thing, like we often won't send a photo until the guy asks. We just don't. And if he asks, then you know, obviously we will. But off the bat, we don't. And I think that's like there is something to that, because the first date, like you don't know. And definitely after being out with someone for a long time, 2 inches doesn't make a difference, or a year and a half doesn't make a difference.
Right. And this is a really important point. What I'm hearing is that people are rejecting shiduchim up front for reasons that had they gone out, those reasons would have been considered insignificant. And it seems that we're losing out on a lot of potential shiduchim that people are rejecting, that if they were a little bit more flexible in realizing that certain things are insignificant, they would be able to go out with people that otherwise could be a very eligible potential spouse for them.
I really believe so.
Right. Also, something to add. I mean, we talk about the shidduch crisis a lot. And I mean, if you think about it, guys will, this is a generalization, of course, but in general, guys will be more likely to go out with young girls younger than them and often not so interested in girls a little bit older than them. So, I mean, that creates a crisis where girls will go out with people who are way older. But that means that at a certain point, say a guy hits 30, he still has girls who are 10 years younger than him. If a girl hits 30, then your options are getting more and more limited. So, I mean, there's so many people say this, but really age, like at a certain point, you're both reach a similar maturity. So I really think that it really shouldn't be as much of a factor.
Understood. So we talked about the challenges of getting a young man, a young woman to agree to go out the first time. Let's say they've gone out once, twice, whatever the case may be. What are the challenges in getting them to go out again and again in order to build that relationship further?
So like I say, you know, sometimes and often the ones that work, it's not such a challenge because they're happy in the beginning. There's maybe a bump or two in the middle, but they're happy at the end. Like often the ones, often sometimes it isn't such a challenge. But I do think that for many people, dating's scary, especially when you're starting out or when you're, you know, in the beginning. And I would just say for anecdotally, given that we're only, you know, in our mid-20s, the people we're setting up are often, it's that, you know, they've only started dating a year ago, 2 years ago. So they're inexperienced daters mostly. And given that, like sometimes people are a bit self-conscious, a bit nervous. And I think that to get them to focus on what's similar between them, the 80% compatibility instead of the 20% of different, you know, slightly different ashkafa, slightly different, whatever it is, the 20% that's maybe less compatible, getting them to focus on the 80% that is compatible, that the reason, you know, that we thought of it in the first place is super important.
Right.
A lot of challenges in setting people up. First date, second date, third date. What keeps you motivated
to keep setting people up, despite the challenges, despite having to speak with six people and getting a number of rejections, and this person bringing this inane reason to reject a shidduch, and this person bringing this silly reason. Sometimes they're valid, sometimes they're not, but you keep on going. Six in one day, and you've done over 100 attempts at shidduchim. What's the motivator?
It's funny. I say to Noah, sometimes I feel like I'm dating again. I always say I keep getting more rejected than I ever was. I go again and again, guys are saying they're not interested. Girls are saying you're not interesting. You're like, well, I'm not good enough. But I think that, I mean, we were set up by mutual friends. My roommate knew Noah. Her brother learned with Noah. And I thought I owe this huge hakara at top. Like, she literally gave us our marriage. So I think, as annoying as it is, and you often, when you set people up, you feel like a yenta sometimes. And yes, you have to go up to people and say, oh, do you think she's cute? Like, it's not like the funnest thing to do. But I think at the end of the day, it's the hugest gift you can ever give someone. It's really amazing. And I think it's totally worth it.
And the money.
Not in Israel.
Get the shatanas. Mr. Tradansky, let me target a question for you. What's your advice to your husband's single friends regarding dating? For example, what mistakes are they making? What would you say if they're asking you one piece of advice that you would give them in order to be more successful in their dating?
Well, can I give a general one, advice to everyone, or you'd like it more specifically to be just towards his friends? Because originally it was going to be the pickiness.
No, your choice, your choice. Men in general.
Okay, so originally I was going to say to men, sometimes men will focus on, like we discussed, they'll often focus on, again, this is generalization, but from my experience, will focus on things like heart or things like that. But I would say, just in general, I think there's an issue with people making calls. So I think what will happen is, guys, I've seen this before with setting certain guys up. They'll respond to me, oh yeah, well, I asked my one friend and he doesn't think it's a call. I don't really know why it's become a thing that when and people do this with like a professional shadchan friend setting you up. It doesn't matter who. They'll ask friends and say, oh, do you think it's a call?
What is a call?
Do you think it's a call? Mean like, do you think we're compatible? Do you think we're my team?
You ask your one friend. Do you think you've seen her one time
across the machitza, like, what do you think? And I know it's happened because when we were dating, people would often say to us, like, oh, I don't see the call. And because it happens to be, we're both super loud and no one actually, everyone's like, what? Too loud people. But I think it's a big, big problem that people will often just ask other people their opinions. I can say personally, someone who was dating someone recently asked Noah and I if we thought it was a call. She said, like, could you see this as a call? And I said to her, yeah, I think it's amazing. I actually thought it was a really bad idea. Someone else had set this couple up, and I thought it was a bad idea. But of course, I had nothing to do with it. I didn't set them up. So I said, yeah, it sounds amazing. Well, and we were just at their wedding last night. So I think it goes to show that you really don't know anything. Not you, I mean, like me. And who am I to decide for someone else whether their relationship will be successful or not? Like, we know that setting people up is literally as hard as Kriyas Yamsuf. So I think when people, especially people our age, will just decide whether to give commentary on if they think it's good, or ask their friends who don't necessarily know this person so well. Like, you don't really know if a relationship will work out. The best thing to ask is direct questions. Like, do you think that, what does this girl believe in? And specific questions. But in terms of asking people in general, do you think we're compatible? I think that's a little bit dangerous.
Interesting. So Noah, let's move it on to you. What's your advice to your wife's friends, single friends, or in general for young ladies who are dating? What would you say to them in order to make their dating more successful?
So I would say two main things. Perhaps the first one is, you know, we're actually speaking today. A friend reached out to us and said, hey, you know, I've been kind of dating for a while. Is anyone you can think of? One of Rukhama's friends. Okay, is there anyone you can think of for me? And I think, you know, like, guys don't have as much of a problem doing that, like putting themselves out there, asking if their friends' wives know, have friends for them. Like, but girls are sometimes less comfortable doing that. I don't know if it's confidence. I don't know what it is. Or maybe it's new. It could come from any sort of source. But girls are less comfortable putting themselves out there. And I think you know, when she sent that message to Rukhama, we were like, yo, we'd only be too happy. Like, we definitely That's awesome. With pleasure. Of course, we'll think about you. And I think like girls putting themselves more out there is definitely a good idea. But that also kind of goes to the second point, and that is that girls should know that their friends or shadchanim or their parents, etc., are thinking about them. A lot of the time, you'll send the suggestion to the guy first, and so often girls are only seeing the vetted suggestions. They're getting the vetted list. And sometimes you're sending a suggestion to a guy and he says no, but she would have said no. And if he says no, she shouldn't feel the pressure to say yes. I think often there's this impression like a girl doesn't get a suggestion for a while, she's very, very nervous. But sometimes plenty of people have been doing work for her behind the scenes. And she should just have, confidence that Siat Bishmai, it will turn out well.
Right, very important.
Right. Also, back to your point about what I would tell guys. Actually, I was going to say this and then I forgot. Is Derech Eretz. I think originally, I don't know how many people do this, but I always knew that it was a thing that you ask the guy first. And I didn't really know what it was originally. I was like, why do you necessarily have to ask the guy first? And I realized after trying to set people up, it's just because guys are ruder. From my experience, that girls will usually give you around 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, something within a week. Guys can decide over a month, maybe, maybe not. So I've actually found in my experience, it's easier to ask a guy. Again, I'm not generalizing, not all men are like this, but from trying to set people up, often men will take a lot longer and they'll take their time. And I think it's a little bit problematic. Like there's a reasonable response time. But I think that is number one of the reasons why people will ask girls afterwards. It also because maybe guys are more likely to say no, given the fact that there are more girls, whatever the reason. But again, like Noah said, I think a lot of girls sometimes feel like people aren't. They have a tendency to think, not all girls, but I've found people have thought that other people aren't necessarily thinking of them because you haven't gotten a suggestion in a while. But it often means because people are asking guys first that, yes, they're the first line of defense. So if you would have said no as well, they'll also say no. So by the time it gets to you, it's already been so vetted that there's just going to be less suggestions naturally.
And the girl's going to have to wait less time then. If you go to her first and then go to him and he's going to drink up, then that would be that lack of derech eretz. Right. Towards her. And that's certainly not a way to start off a marriage or continue a marriage for that matter. Let me ask you another question. Advice to amateur shadchanim, people who are considering doing this or starting to do this, what would you tell them in order to assist them in being successful and being a good shadchan?
So Noah and I were actually discussing that the people who have actually gotten married that I've set up, most of them have actually not been like not anyone that I really know so well. I mean, just for example, one time one of Noah's friends had to break our yichud, so he kept opening the door so we wouldn't be in yichud. And when we were engaged and we were checking out our apartment, and I thought of him for our friend, and they're our neighbors now. And it was so random. I barely knew him. He just came in to check our yichud. But sometimes, dafka, when it's someone you don't know as well, you don't focus on the small ins and outs of, because people are complex and we have so many aspects to our personality and people could go either way. And sometimes when you have someone who doesn't really know you so well and just thinks, oh, he's loud, oh, she's whatever, sometimes actually the people who generalize and just make those quick calls that are the ones that actually get it. Whereas when it's someone you know very well, you tend to overthink it. So I think always just suggest, I think people feel like you need to be their best friend and know every aspect of their personality, but actually sometimes it's the opposite. Just like go for it. Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Last question for you. If you had the opportunities to sit with an experienced shadchan and say, we've been doing this, we've done between 100, 200 shiduchim attempts at setting people up, but we want a piece of advice. What advice would like you like to receive from an experienced shadchan? Input. Advice.
Something I actually think about is when you're the middleman, sometimes it's very difficult to go between people. So if someone says, I don't know, she breathes too loudly, and then you have to go back and tell this guy, let's say the girl says to the guy, he breathes too loudly, I hate the way he breathes. How do you say that to a guy? So it's one thing if it's you saying it, but you need to make the person you're talking about not sound bad, because people always, there's many people who've gone out, it didn't work out, and then they tried again a couple years later and it didn't would work out. So you don't want them to sound bad, but you also don't want to sound like a bad person, or they don't get back to you, say, for months.
Or stupid. You don't want to sound stupid, like, oh, yeah. he just isn't interested. Like, you can't say that. You need to give a real answer.
Right. So often, and people will sometimes press you, and they'll say, oh, well, why? Like, you don't want him to look bad, but you also don't want to look bad. So that's something I'd really want to figure out, how to find that middle ground.
And giving feedback. If you give it, do you give it? And if you give it, how do you give it in a proper way so you're not hurting people's feelings, but giving something substantive maybe that they can learn from?
Yeah, exactly. I totally, especially that they could learn from, you know, because to say, oh, he just wasn't feeling it, that doesn't help anyone. But it's also not so comfortable to say he doesn't think you're attractive, because that's not helpful. And it might help to say he thinks you talk too much, but how exactly do you package that in a nice way that's constructive is difficult.
Right. Also, when you're setting up friends, there's that slight element of them that makes it a little more difficult, is when you're a shadchan, you can just say, oh, you can basically say what you think, and you're the shadchan, that's your job. You can say, man up, you need to answer text. But when it's your own friend, you also can't be that brutish, I guess. So there is a little bit of, that's maybe the added element of complexity there.
Yes, when you're setting up friends, you want to maintain that relationship in a good way, and that definitely adds complexity. But I want to thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. It has been fascinating. There are challenges, but the upside is tremendous, and the mitzvah is even greater. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shalom Aleichem, this is Ari Wasserman taking back the microphone for our wrap-up, takeaways, and lessons learned. Let's start out with Rabbi Moshe Walter. We talked about the four mitzvahs associated with setting up of shiduchim, uvosidbak, chesed that one is doing to both sides, the chas and the kala, and also Rabbi Walter's chiddush, hashavas aveda, and number four, hechsher mitzvah, of one of the questions where we will be asked, ad mea ve'esrim asakta bepiria veribia. Also, he did tell us that the Gdolim did and do set up Shiduchim. And also we had a fascinating conversation, halachic issues in setting up two frum people, two non-Jews, a frum and a non-frum Jew. That was a very interesting analysis. And also fascinating was Rabbi Walter's openness to online dating. That was a very interesting conversation as well, but it has to be the right site. And also he did tell us it's certainly an option, but not the only option. We spoke with Rabbi David Shon about the financial aspects of Shadchanus, the fee that is paid, and he walked us through that it's one of two options. Either the fee is based on the concept of Poel or Yored, and there are a number of nafkaminas between those. Also, what came out over and over is the importance of Minhag. The importance of Minhag, we'll define that as common practice, local common practice, dictating the amount of the fee, for example, how much an amateur gets versus a professional, and also the concept brought for financial matters in Choshen Mishpat. Minhag Mevatal Alacha, the importance of the Minhag, the common practice, is absolutely critical. Also, we had a conversation of the complexity of dividing up the Shadchanis fee when there are multiple Shadchanim involved. There could be a maskil, somebody who suggests a gomer at the end, and also an emtsai if somebody's involved in the middle. So that is a complicated area in halacha. Also, changing shadchanim in the middle, that is also a very complicated issue. And the importance of asking shailas when anything comes up. We had a fascinating conversation with Mrs. Levitan and Shlomo Lowenstein. They are shadchanim, Mrs. Levitan in Israel, Shlomo Lowenstein in Lakewood in the United States. And just a comment about the two of them before I talk about the substance of what we discussed. Throughout the conversation, I was amazed and touched by each of their sensitivity and empathy for the boys and girls, for the men and the women that they work with. So that was really something, and I definitely appreciated their sensitivity that they have in all aspects of their work. I did think going into that discussion that we'd have dramatic differences in the practices and the minhagim between Israel and the United States, but that is not the case. It seems that for the most part, the practices are aligned. There were some differences, some very interesting differences. For example, the initial dates in the United States are longer than those in Israel. The United States, 3 hours would be standard. Eretz Yisrael, half of that amount, maybe a little more than half. The location of the initial dates in the United States in a lobby in Israel, Mrs. Levitan told us that oftentimes it could be in an apartment or a home, obviously being careful about the issues, but that was very interesting. And also another significant, and there's this was a very significant difference. The financial aspects when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, the buying of apartments for newlyweds, especially if the boy is going to be staying and learning. So there would be more support for somebody who's going to be staying and learning. On the other hand, in the United States, it's monthly support for a few years. It depends the amount of support, the number of years. But what was very interesting and very different from the practices in Israel is that the support is going to be lower for those who are very serious about learning. Why? Because for the most part, they are marrying the daughters of the Rosh Yeshiva, the Malamdim, the Mechanchim, and accordingly, they don't have the ability to support somebody who's going to be staying and learning, somebody who's very serious about learning. So that was a very different approach between Eretz Yisrael and the United States. Another interesting point, asking the Shadchanim, do you need to adhere to the strict specifics and the specifications of what the boy is looking for and what the girl is looking for? And the answer was, not really, if it's not significant. Meaning, I asked, do you have to adhere to X, Y, and Z? And Shlomo responded, it depends what the Z is. Is disease something that is important and significant or not? Because if it's not significant, you don't have to adhere to the T. Dot the I's, crosses the T's to every single specification that somebody is looking for. We want to set things up. We want people to move forward. And it's important to not get stuck on the details that are not significant when it comes to marriage. Also, another point, setting up a couple is not about the shadchan. For example, if you have a shadchan that likes the boy and likes the girl, likes the man, likes the woman, and says, I like both of them, it must be that they are a good couple. It really does not work that way. It's not about the shadchan liking this friend and that friend, but the issue is this a good match? Does the boy, the man, the woman, the girl, are they a good match together? So the shadchan has to subjugate his own desires. In fact, this week's Parsha, Parshas Vayikra, we read almost all the way at the beginning, a core concept when it comes to korbanos, yakriv oso liyertzono lifnei Hashem, talking about the korban ola, bring the korban voluntarily. But the ksav haKabbalah says something very different. He says the ikur kavana of a korban is that the person who's bringing the korban has to bring his entire ratzon, his entire motivation and desire to be an oved Hashem, all of his kolchos, his desires, etc. He has to turn them over to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he accordingly reads this pasuk, Yakriv Oso Liritzono. What are you being makriv? We typically say you're being makriv the korban. You have to be makriv yourself. You have to be makriv. You have to subjugate your own desires. Yakriv Oso Liritzono. Be makriv your desires to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ikur is not bringing the physical korban, but it's bringing your desires and subjugating your desires. So to hear when it comes to Ashidach, it's not what you want. It's what makes sense as a great match for that hopefully future chassan and kala. Also, another important point, Eitza for the amateurs, people who are going to start setting up shiduchim, somebody who is starting, who has started, who has listened to our show, and Emir Tzashem, we will have shiduchim set up as a result of listening to our discussion today. Amateurs should get Eitzas. They should get Eitzas and help whenever necessary from the veteran Shadchanim. We then spoke with David Katzoff, who said everyone should be making Shiduchim, especially newlyweds, because you both know the Chasan, the Kala, you know boys, you know girls, set them up. We have so many potential matches, 20 men, 20 women, that equals to 400 potential matches. That doesn't mean they're all going to be good, but start thinking about all of the possibilities. We had a very important conversation about why are boys and men and girls and women rejecting offers, not even agreeing to go out. And it turns out that men oftentimes are rejecting because of the photo. They saw the picture. They don't think that's going to work. Photos are detrimental oftentimes to proper shiduchim. We could get yeses without supplying those photos. And it could very well be that when you meet each other, the personality comes out and there is attraction. So oftentimes we are losing shiduchim because of these photos. Also, he said social media is a problem. People are looking for an excuse to say no. And also, especially when it comes to women, hashkafa segmenting, getting so too stuck in specifics of hashkafa, so we are saying no in advance. His advice, be more flexible in what you're looking for. And also, mentorship for those who are dating is really important also. And this is a fascinating point. Improve the quality of the men, of the boys who are dating, because it seems that we have more women, more girls who are of higher quality. Gentlemen, let's get with the program. Let's improve ourselves so we're worthy of the women we are dating. Last, we spoke with Noah and Ruchama Tradansky, and they said that boys and girls, men and women are rejecting possible shiduchim for reasons that are insignificant. They could be or are foregoing what could be their spouse for reasons that they seem valid, they think are valid, but are really not that important in the scheme of things. There are lots of challenges in setting up shiduchim, but it is hugely important. And also, they did stress the importance of newlyweds setting up their friends, but it doesn't have to be only your friends. It could be anyone. You don't even have to know people so well, but just set up the shiduchim. One thing that we did not discuss on today's show is the fee, the specifics of the fee, the shadchanis fee. So I did a little bit research and I had emails with shadchanim and it came out as follows. We'll talk about rates in the United States. We'll talk about rates in Israel. I don't have rates for elsewhere. If people have the rates for elsewhere out of the U.S. and Israel, please email in. And if you have different opinions, different minhagim in also Israel and the U.S., please email us. We'll post it on the website. So when it comes to the United States, and this is each side would pay the minimum fees are $1,500. Some neighborhoods are starting at $2,000, but the fee does increase depending on the situation. So that would be the bare minimum for each side. People pay what they want. This is, I'm quoting from one of the shadchanim I emailed. People pay what they want. He does not set up the fee in advance. They pay any time starting from engagement until the wedding. And he, his policy is to not to discuss the fee. This is actually something we talked about with Rabbi Shon, and that is what he did say, that shadchanim in the United States, for the most part, are not discussing the fee and they leave it up to the people, but we do have the standards and you should adhere with what is acceptable, what is paid, and it does increase based on income. The more comfortable people are, the more the shadchanis is. The rates when it comes to Eretz Yisrael and the timing of the payment in Eretz Yisrael, it's paid at engagement, and broken engagements, Rachmana Litzlan, are not halachically refundable. The fee in Eretz Yisrael for many years has been approximately $1,000 minimum. That's what the fee was. Things have changed a little bit now. People have gone off the dollar usage and have gone into shkolim because of the fluctuations in the exchange rates. Beginners or non-professional shadchanim usually get around 4,000 shkolim. Professionals get more. It goes up to even 7,000 shkolim. And the practice in Israel is to ask in advance or for the shadchan to inform in advance. So we do have interesting different practices when it comes to, do we have an agreement up front as to what the fee is? It seems that at least some shadchanim in the United States, they will take what they get. There's an understanding what it will be, but they're not upfront with the fee in Eretz Yisrael. They are more upfront. And I do want to say a general concept here. There have been maybe insults or comments to shadchanim. Why do you make so much money for just a few phone calls? And that is not correct. The amount of effort and time that is typically put in by a shadchan is unbelievable. If they would compute what they're making per hour, it's not very much. They invest in each and every suggestion, hours and hours before even getting to one date, and then hours spent on feedback and mentoring and guidance to the candidates, to the parents. It is an all-consuming effort to set up a couple and then to mentor and guide through the entire process. So I think our perspectives should really be, when it comes to shadchan, that we are delighted to pay. We pay a lot for weddings, way more, and without a shadchan there wouldn't be a wedding. So we should be delighted if somebody brings a proper chasan, kala, son-in-law, daughter-in-law into the family. That is a shaliach of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, whether it be a professional or an amateur, and we should be delighted, ecstatic to pay what the rate is. I do want to end off with, again, Parshas Vayikra, an amazing, amazing vort. I think it's amazing. And it goes as follows. In a number of places, and talking about the Karbonis, the Gemara tells us this, that it says the language of Reyach Nichoach LaHashem, that the Karbon should be a beautiful aroma to HaKadosh Baruch. And in fact, it says that when talking about the Karbon Ola brought from a behema, an animal offering that's the most expensive. And it says the same language when talking about a Karbon Ola again, but an off, less expensive. a bot from a fowl, bot from a bird, specific types of birds. It says the same language, reach nichoach, and also when it comes to a korban mincha, again, it says the same language. And even though the first type, the behemoth, is much more expensive, and the off is less expensive, and the korban mincha is really inexpensive, nonetheless, it says the same language, reach nichoach la Hashem. And the Gemara in Menachos learns from that, it's coming to teach us a very important lesson, lomar lecha echad amar beh, bechad hamamit ubivad shechaven libo l'shamayim. Somebody may do a lot. They may spend a lot for a korban. They may spend very little for the korban. But the point is we should be mechaven our lev. We should do it with the proper intentions. And we're going to bring something. Whether it be a korban ola for that's very expensive or we can't afford it and it's much less. But do something. In fact, it's brought in the name of flaw. It's very interesting. If we look, ubivad shechaven libo lev is our heart. If you look at the letters before the lev, lamed beis, it's aleph and chaf. Aleph and chaf are the two letters before, and if you look at the two letters after lev, a heart, it is the letters gimel and mem, gam. Chazal tell us that ach and gam have special usages. When we see the word ach, it is a limitation. It's lemayet. It's coming to exclude. On the other hand, when we see the language gam, it's lerabos, it's to include, it's to do more. And that's exactly the point here. When we have a lev, lev is in the middle. Somebody may do more, may do gam, that's lerabos. Somebody may do less, that's lemayet. But the key is to do something. Echad amar be'ev, echad amamid, ubivad shechaved libo l'shamayim. We have to do something and we have to have the proper kavanas. And I would say the same thing as it applies to shiduchim. Some people, they know more people. They have more ideas. They have more time. Do more. Some people, less. I have less time, less opportunities. I have less options. I have fewer people. But the key here is to do something. To do something, keep our eyes open for opportunities and setting people up. Because as we said, as Mordechai said to Esther, Umi Yodeya, Im le'es kazos higat lemalchus. This is for us, and we may be the only person alive that can set up the shidduch. Let's keep our eyes open. Let's look for those opportunities and let's act on them.